It is exactly 6 o'clock. It's Thursday, June 24th, 2021. Good evening and welcome to Project JFK's CSI Dallas presentation of The Journey on the Trail of Truth and JFK Assassination. This is our second portion of our Spotlight series with special guest Dr. John Newman. I'm your host, David Knight, and along with my co-directors, Casey Quinlan and Brian Edwards, we want to thank you for attending tonight's special presentation. We want to encourage everyone to visit our website, projectjfk.com, and see what we have to offer the research community. You will find photos, videos, and other research materials not posted on any other website related to the Kennedy assassination. Our site is constantly being updated, and new items are being added weekly. Our site is free to visit, and the information is available for everyone to enjoy. If you missed last night's meeting, the replay has been uploaded to our website in the events section and on our YouTube channel for you to watch. There is also a MP3 file that you can download and take with you without video. If you wish to support our cause, there is a donate button on our homepage, and you are free to make a donation if you wish. We are not a nonprofit organization, and the donations help us to update the website with groundbreaking research. Your donations also help sponsor programs like what you're going to experience tonight. So click the donate button and help us continue for the search for the truth. Before we begin, we want to mention the ground rules for tonight's presentation. There are portions of tonight's presentation which Dr. Newman has pre-recorded. After the first part, we will stop the pre-recorded portion of the presentation, and we will have approximately 30 minutes or thereabouts for live Q&A. Please keep your microphones on mute during the presentation and during the Q&A portion. The chat feature has been disabled, and your questions will be directed to me, which I will forward to Dr. Newman. Please limit your questions to the section of Dr. Newman's presentation that are presented prior to each live portion of our meeting. Please stay on topic and keep your questions short and to the point to allow others to ask their questions. Some questions may not be submitted to Dr. Newman because of time constraints. Please be respectful to your fellow attendees so everyone can enjoy the meeting. Anyone in attendance that does not follow the guidelines and code of conduct may be ejected from the meeting and possibly may not be admitted back in. This is our second meeting in our new format that is known as our Spotlight Series. These events will focus on one keynote speaker giving their presentation, and I want to welcome back our special guest, Dr. John Newman. Dr. Newman is an adjunct professor of political science at James Madison University. He is a retired U.S. Army intelligence officer who served as a strategic intelligence cryptologic analyst before accepting a special two-year appointment to become military assistant to Director General William Odom at the National Security Agency. Dr. Newman's work as a historian of consequence has overturned orthodoxies, broken new ground, and introduced new facts about America during the Cold War. He has written several books, in particular JFK in Vietnam, Oswald and the CIA, Where Angels Tread Lightly, The Assassination of JFK Volume 1, Countdown to Darkness, The Assassination of JFK Volume 2, Into the Storm, The Assassination of JFK Volume 3, and his upcoming book, Armageddon, The Assassination of JFK Volume 4. Tonight, Dr. Newman's preview of Volume 4, Armageddon, is not about a standalone book. It is the end product of a work in progress that began 11 years ago, when he decided to go back to the beginning for a fresh start. In his three successive works so far, Dr. Newman has discarded a large number of false pieces from the puzzle of JFK's presidency and assassination. At the same time, he has added lost pieces that have one by one broken new ground and overturned unworkable orthodoxies. Dr. Newman's rigorous methodology has exposed the wizard behind the curtain and his cover and deception operations that have for so long concealed a clear picture of this dystopian war puzzle. And with that, it is my pleasure to welcome back Dr. John Newman.
Thank you. I'll keep it short. I just want to thank again Casey Quinlan, Brian Edwards, and David Knight at the Project JFK CSI Dallas team for inviting me and hosting this two-day event. And I also want to mention once again the great work of the research associate team that I have that would include Jay Harvey and Alan Dale, Heather Fear, and, of course, Douglas Horn. So with that, I'll turn it back to you.
Okay, we're going to start off with part three. This is going to cover section 6A, 6B, and we're looking at about 31 minutes, and then we'll be on live with Q&A.
We'll turn now to section 6. Section 6 deals with the Truman administration. There are two parts. In part one, which I will cover now, deals with President Truman and the development of nuclear weapons after World War II.
President Truman had a rough start and a very interesting one to his presidency. Only his innermost circle knew that he suffered from acute anxiety, principally because he failed to crack Roosevelt's inner circle of trusted advisors and knew almost nothing about what was going on in the Oval Office. When a reporter reminded Truman that he was a heartbeat from the White House, he squirmed and said, "Don't say that. I don't let myself think of it." A close advisor recalled that Truman knew that he was going to be the president of the United States, and I think it just scared the devil out of him. I think it frightened him, even the thought of it. Senate UPI correspondent Tony Vaccaro said that Roosevelt, quote, doesn't make use of him. Truman doesn't know what's going on. Roosevelt won't tell him anything. Problems began after the Yalta meeting, right away in February 1945. Stalin accused the United States and the United Kingdom of negotiating a surrender with the Nazis without Russian involvement. So he broke his promise. By the way, that was true. So he broke his promise to support a free Poland that was making trouble elsewhere in Romania, Hungary, and Yugoslavia. On 5 April, Roosevelt said, "We can't do business with Stalin. He has broken every one of the promises he made at Yalta." Roosevelt died at 3:35 p.m. on 12 April 1945. Truman recalled, "It was the only time in my life I think I ever felt like I had a real shock. I'd hurried to the White House that day to see the president, and when I arrived, I found out I was the president." After being sworn in, Truman recalled that Secretary of War Henry Stimson, quote, "wanted me to know about an immense project that was underway, a new explosive of some kind of almost unbelievable destructive power." Truman had heard whispers, but he had no knowledge of any of the details, and Stimson explained it was so secret that he could not reveal anything more for the time being. Truman thought, quote, "I knew the president had numerous meetings with Churchill and Stalin, but I was not familiar with any of them. Meanwhile, General Patton told Generals Eisenhower and Bradley about his disgust with the idea of Truman as president, and that vice presidents are never intended, neither by party nor by the Lord, to be president." Well, on 25 April, Truman received a note from physicist Albert Einstein saying, quote, "In 4 months, we'll have completed the most terrible weapon ever known in human history, one bomb of which could destroy a whole city," unquote. The U.S. atomic bomb experiment began 6 years earlier on 2 August 1939. A letter signed by Einstein said the element uranium may be turned into a new and important source of energy. He added that it was conceivable, quote, that extremely powerful bombs of a new type may thus be constructed. Back on the 27th of June, 1940, Roosevelt created the National Defense Research Committee, NDRC. This top secret group employed the brightest minds in physics to devise methods of splitting atoms to find out if such highly theoretical ideas could be weaponized. The bomb project was given to the U.S. Army, whose chief of staff, George Marshall, closely followed its work through the early years. In 1942, Marshall and Stimson handed the day-to-day control of the project to Major General Leslie Groves. Groves, in turn, appointed J. Robert Oppenheimer as the scientific director of a new secret laboratory where the bomb would be built. Oppenheimer chose the barren land outside the village of Los Alamos, New Mexico, as the location for his secret laboratory. Keeping this work secret from the American public required the strictest of security measures and a bit of luck. Rosenhill had agreed with Churchill at a conference in Quebec in August 1943 to share all atomic technology with the British, and that the two nations had worked together on the project. The early Army budget appropriations were not nearly enough to pay for the project, so Stimson approached a select group of congressional leaders. He informed them of the secret work, and they were able to pilot funds through the Senate and the House without disclosing the money's purpose. By the end of September 1944, Secretary of War Stimson told the NDRC that by the summer of 1945, the project would be a matter of, quote, great military importance, unquote. Stimson also told the NDRC that the program would expand rapidly after the war and that military aspects may become overwhelming. He added prophetically, quote, this country has a temporary advantage which may disappear or even reverse if there is a secret arms race, unquote. For Stimson, what became known as the Manhattan Project had become not just a military matter, but an existential one. On 4 December 1943, the New York Times quoted the German high command saying that the Nazis, quote, intended by one fell drastic stroke to strike against the Allies, and the retaliation would be a powerful expression spiritually and politically because, quote, mankind is not far from the point of where it can at will blow up half the globe, unquote. And so this was the state of the atomic bomb project on 25 April when Truman learned of its details for the first time, April 1945. When he asked for a timeline for a bomb to be ready, the only thing Stimson could offer was, quote, within 4 months, unquote. The president was amazed that an operation of this size could remain so secret. Stimson said the USSR was spying on the work at Los Alamos and that with Nazi Germany's imminent collapse, the Soviets were the only nation capable of putting such a bomb into production within the next 5 years. Stimson added that modern civilization might be completely destroyed. Days after Truman's 25 April meeting with Stimson and Groves on the atomic bomb, the news of the Nazi surrender reached the White House. On the same day, Eisenhower's armies and the Soviet forces met at the Elbe River, having cut Germany in half. To the east, Russian troops stormed Berlin. Now here's a quick chronology how things developed. On June 1st, 1945, the top advisory committee on the Manhattan Project advises Truman to employ the bomb against Japan as soon as possible without prior warning. On June 5th, military leaders from the U.S., the USSR, Britain, and France in Berlin agree on the division of Germany into four zones, one for each. 18 June, Truman meets with his top military advisors to strategize the end of the war with Japan. The leaders agree on plans to invade Japan with nearly 800,000 ground troops. General George Marshall sets D-Day for the Kyushu Island on 1 November. 16 July, the Trinity shot success in New Mexico Desert, the first test of an atomic bomb. And on 17 July, Truman meets Stalin for the first time as they discuss the deterioration of U.S.-Soviet relations. Truman tells Stalin he has an atomic bomb. And finally, on 6 August, the little boy destroys Hiroshima. On 8 August, USSR enters the war against Japan. And on 9 August, Fat Man destroys Nagasaki. 15 August, Japan surrenders. The United States already had a target committee working on the selection of cities in Japan. The B-29 Super Fortress would have a 1,500-mile range while carrying the estimated weight of the bomb. That would be enough distance from an air base in the Mariana Islands to place the weapon on a primary target inside mainland Japan. Meanwhile, the Red Army continued its aggression in Austria. It appeared that Ambassador Herrmann's fear that the Russians were planning a barbarian invasion of Europe was becoming fact, although it wasn't true. The U.S. State Department concluded that, quote, a future war with Soviet Russia is as certain as anything in this world, unquote. And so Truman approved dropping atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The Hiroshima bomb occurred on 6 August, prompting the Soviet Union to immediately enter the war, which it did on 8 August. Truman had been shaken by the extent of civilian casualties at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. He said, quote, the thought of wiping out another 100,000 people was too horrible. Truman didn't like the idea of killing, as he said, all those kids. The third bomb, another Fat Man, had been ready for assembly and delivery in the final days before the Japanese surrender on 15 August. But Truman had ordered atomic bombing stopped after the first two bombs were used, in case the United Nations banned them. When it became clear that it was not going to happen, and that the USSR was threatening Berlin, Truman accelerated the nuclear bomb production plan in the United States, but he kept the bomb under his control by requiring the Air Force to get permission from the Atomic Energy Commission just to load the weapons onto the aircraft. Okay, I'll run through a few more, a little bit of chronology here. On January and February of 1946, according to a USSR plan, nationalist and communist parties in China agreed to form a coalition government there. In March 1946, the Soviet withdrawal from Manchuria sparked war in China and a stunning nationalist defeat of the communists. So by mid-1946, Stalin altered strategy and spurned further cooperation with the United States. Stalin also switched to unilateral support for the communists. Truman didn't know about this. In June 1946, Truman was still pursuing the coalition policy in China. And so he imposes an embargo on the nationalists to preserve parity. While the nationalists are forced to switch to a defensive strategy, Moscow now moves to build up the communist military strength and control of Manchuria. So in May 47, Truman lifts the embargo on the nationalists, but no large-scale resumption of U.S. military aid followed. Secretary of State George Marshall was instrumental in blocking U.S. congressional efforts to provide China funds for arms. And that is how things fell apart in China. Stalin secretly changes strategy, and Truman doesn't know about it until it's too late. So as a result, on 1 October 1949, Mao Zedong proclaims the founding of the People's Republic of China in the Tiananmen Square of Beijing. In retrospect, by spring 47, the U.S. was no longer the formidable power it had been during World War II. The Army demobilized from 89 divisions to 15 divisions. The Air Force pared down from 217 active air groups to just two, and the Navy was also reduced in size. The U.S. purposely declined to support the nationalists to avoid a long civil war and division of China like that in Korea and Germany. The Truman administration took an unfortunate calculated risk that a territorial integrated China, even under communist leadership, would ultimately be governed by national rather than ideological commitments. And I just want to do a shout out to my mentor, Dr. Richard Thorne, under whom I studied for years at George Washington, as we put this scenario together and published. All right, I'm going to move along to Section 6, Part B. President Truman, the bomb, and the Korean War. While the Chinese Communist Army was mopping up and nearing victory in China during 1948, another major international crisis was brewing in Berlin. In March 1948, Britain, France, and the United States decided to combine their sections of Berlin into one unified West Berlin, angering the Soviets further. In June 1948, the Soviet Union, whose territory fully surrounded the capital, cut off all ground traffic into and out of West Berlin in an attempt to force the Allies to abandon the city. The blockade of Berlin had begun. As Truman and his advisors considered how to respond, many people took seriously the British warning that anything other than diplomatic activity would almost certainly lead to an incident and the opening of World War III. British General Montgomery said, "The city has no military value. In fact, it's a first-class military liability." On 26 June 1948, 2 days after the Soviets imposed the Berlin blockade, the military governor of the U.S. zone in Germany, General Lucius Clay, gave the order for the Berlin airlift, which was only later authorized by President Truman. And that's interesting. General Clay did not believe the war was likely, but thought the risk had to be run if the Russians were to be stopped. Ultimately, Truman determined that it was of utmost importance that the United States retain a presence in Berlin. Truman and the remaining allies began the Berlin Airlift, an operation that carried food, fuel, and other supplies into West Berlin by plane. The effort required a lot of careful planning and many resources, but the airlift allowed the United States to keep a foothold in post-war Germany. While the Berlin blockade was one of the first major international crises of the Cold War, in the future there would be even more dangerous American-USSR nuclear-tinged crises over Berlin. The Berlin blockade began on 24 June 1948, and it lasted nearly a year, ending on 12 May 1949. 3 months later, on 29 August 1949, the Soviet Union secretly conducted its first successful nuclear weapons test at Semipalatinsk in Kazakhstan. Named First Lightning by the Russians, the RDS-1 bomb was based on the U.S. Fat Man plutonium design. Truman's acceleration of the nuclear arms program early in the Cold War produced a tactical surface-to-surface nuclear missile named Honest John. With a range of over 30 miles, it was first successfully tested in 1951 and deployed in Europe in 1954. On 1 November 1952, the first hydrogen bomb ever tested, named Mike, was part of the Livermore Labs Operation Ivy. Mike was detonated on Inuktitut Atoll and had a yield of 10.4 megatons. Some of the scientists who helped build Mike questioned whether it was more destructive than any war aim could justify. By this time, however, the Cold War was unstoppable. If the U.S. could build an H-bomb, the Soviets could too. Just months later, the Soviets tested a bomb that came close to matching the explosive power of the H-bomb. And so, the race was on to build these preposterous super bombs in huge numbers. Now I have an interesting story for you. For more than 60 years, historians and U.S. officials at the time of the 25 June 1950 North Korean attack on South Korea believed it occurred because of a speech by Truman's Secretary of State Acheson on 12 January 1950. His speech outlined a new U.S. Pacific defense posture that included Japan and the Philippines but did not explicitly include Korea. Now, popular wisdom has it that the Acheson speech was the key to Stalin's permission for the North Korean attack on South Korea. But Stalin, it turns out, knew long before Acheson's speech that Korea was not in the new U.S. Pacific defense perimeter. In February 1949, the KGB, at the time it was still called the MGB, had recruited, we'll call him Jack, or they called him Jack, actually, an American code clerk in Moscow, compromised with his mistress in bed. That enabled the KGB to break the U.S. ciphers at a critical moment in the Cold War. Only 8 people in the world, aside from the recruiter himself, Sergei Kondrashev, pictured here, were aware of these details and the cipher break. Jack had given the Soviets what every government most wants, and having obtained, most needs to hide, the ability to read the secret communications of its rivals and potential enemies. Soviet Minister of Security, Viktor Abakumov, told Kondrashev that these authentic insights into American thinking had been especially persuasive for Stalin at this particular moment. And that moment occurred early in 1949, long before the Acheson speech. Stalin, knowing that the U.S. military's Pacific defensive perimeter would not include Korea, decided it was a propitious moment to test the situation and announce the evacuation of Russian troops from North Korea. Stalin's move was a devious device. It was meant to test the secret information about American intentions in Korea gained from the cipher machine break that had resulted from the KGB's recruitment of Jack. Well, it worked. Truman directed MacArthur to remove all U.S. troops from South Korea. They were gone by the end of June 1949, still a long time before the Acheson speech, at which point MacArthur's responsibility for Korea ceased. Consequently, Acheson's speech the next year and his omission of Korea from America's defensive perimeter drew little notice until later when the attack came on 25 June 1950. Jack's information had enabled the KGB to actually assemble a copy of the machine, and they could read secret American diplomatic and military communications between Washington and all the American posts around the world. Although this revelation was released in Pete Bagley's 2013 book, CIA counterintelligence specialist, his book Spy Master, amazingly, no published observer has noticed this expose except for my 2019 volume, Into the Storm. Jack and the Cipher Break are what caused the outbreak of the Korean War. Okay, I want to run swiftly through a chronology of some of the events going forward here. 12 January 1950, the North Korean leader Kim Il-sung proposes the liberation of South Korea to the Soviets. After weeks of exchanges between Beijing, Moscow, and Pyongyang, by early spring, Kim secured pledges of support for the invasion from Stalin and Mao Zedong. 25 June, a massive artillery barrage from North Korea begins the Korean War. Roughly 100,000 North Korean troops pour across the 38th parallel. And although South Korean forces are driven back, they retire in good order. 27 June, the UN Security Council Resolution 83 authorizes UN members to give military aid to South Korea. The USSR could have vetoed the resolution, but it boycotted it because the nationalist government in Taiwan still had China's seat on the Security Council. In the event, Seoul fell the next day. Okay, a little more chronology here. 12 September 1950, North Korean troops reached the utmost point of advance. Although thousands of UN troops reinforced South Korea, months of fighting reduced the area under their control to a 5,000 square mile rectangle centered on the critical southeastern port of Pusan, the Pusan perimeter. But by that time, the North Korean invasion force reached the Pusan perimeter, its strength had been nearly cut in half, and it was almost entirely without armor. 15 September, the American 10th Corps, a force led by U.S. Major General Edmund Allman, staged an audacious amphibious landing at Incheon, some 150 miles behind enemy lines. The plan, conceived by U.N. Commander General Douglas MacArthur, was an unqualified success. 10 days later, Seoul was recaptured, and the bulk of the Northern Korean Army was destroyed. Lacking diplomatic relations with the United States, China relayed warnings through India to Washington and Tokyo. On 2 October, Prime Minister Zhou Enlai warned that if American troops crossed the 38th parallel, China would intervene in the war. The British were particularly alarmed by the Chinese warning. The UK and its Commonwealth allies had the second largest contingent of troops, two brigades, in the UN force in Korea. Ignoring the Chinese warning, MacArthur pushed into North Korea. On 25 October 1950, as his forces approached the Yalu River, Chinese People's Volunteers Force, CPVF, troops under veteran commander General Peng Dehuai crossed into North Korea and inflicted serious losses on the lead units of the advancing UN forces. According to a State Department official, Robert Bowie, the shock of the North Korean surprise attack on South Korea on 25 June led President Truman to take the lid off of nuclear weapons production. The Atomic Energy Commission had 8 sites and 55,000 employees in 1950. It was expanded to 20 sites and 142,000 employees by 1953, and the expansion continued. Nevertheless, as the years went by, Truman became increasingly critical of the use of atomic bombs. He put it this way, "You've got to understand that this isn't a military weapon. It's used to wipe out women and children and unarmed people, and not for military uses. So we have got to treat this thing differently from rifles and cannons and ordinary things like that." In 1953, Truman said that the atomic bomb is far worse than gas and biological warfare because it affects the civilian population and murders them by wholesale. The sudden appearance of enormous amounts of Chinese forces sent the main body of UN forces reeling back to the south bank of the Chongcheon River. On 6 December 1950, the U.S. Marines at the Chosin Reservoir began to engage in a fighting retreat to the port of Hungnam. Two entire Chinese armies had been tasked with the destruction of the 1st Marine Division. They succeeded in driving the American force from North Korean territory, but paid an enormous price. As many as 80,000 Chinese troops were killed or wounded, and the CPVF 9th Army Group is rendered combat ineffective for months. Frozen Chosin became one of the most storied episodes in U.S. Marine Corps history. MacArthur's loyal intelligence chief, G2, was General Charles Willoughby. He had been with his commander since 1939, and he was a sycophant. He doctored the intelligence to permit MacArthur's forces to go where they wanted, to the banks of the Alum. MacArthur's authority put America's new civilian intelligence agency, the CIA, in an awkward position. The agency was not permitted to have a representative in Tokyo or to participate in preparing intelligence estimates for the Eighth Army. A false intelligence estimate of the number of the Chinese forces in Korea, undoubtedly originating from the cookbooks of General Willoughby, reported less than one-tenth of their true number. MacArthur's plan continued. Then, reinforced by Chinese nationalist troops, if I were permitted to use them, and with American reinforcement on the way, I would make simultaneous amphibious and airborne landings at the upper end of both coasts of North Korea and close a gigantic trap. The Chinese would soon starve or surrender. Without food and ammunition, they would become helpless. Everything the Chinese used in the way of food or munitions had to come across the border. The Reds had only 10 days supply of food in their North Korean dumps to feed nearly a million troops, and their ammunition was equally limited. President Truman and his National Security Council had admonished MacArthur that under no circumstances should other UN forces, particularly U.S. forces, be used in the northeastern province bordering the Soviet Union or in the area along the Manchurian border. History professor Brands observed, if MacArthur did formulate such plans at the time, he had fairly lost touch with reality in Washington. He had been told again and again there would be no summons of the Chinese nationalists. He had been repeatedly ordered not to bomb across the Alum. And as for sowing radioactive material in North Korea or China, his thinking was delusional. Joint Chiefs Chairman Omar Bradley shook his head in wonder and said MacArthur understood perfectly well that the clearing of North Korea had long since been ruled out. The president wanted an end to the fighting, not an escalation of it. General Bradley recalled that in the first week of April 1951, the Truman administration felt more fearful than ever about the possibility of the outbreak of World War III. We had recently, he said, we recently received alarming intelligence information from a classified source that the Soviet Union was preparing for a major military move. Where? We did not know. One suggestion, taken with utmost seriousness, was that they would intervene in Korea. Another was that they might attempt to overrun Western Europe. Truman wrote in his diary, "Rank insubordination. This looks like the last straw. MacArthur has made himself a center of controversy, publicly and privately. He told me the war in Korea was over, that we could transfer a regular division to Germany on 1 January. He was positive Red China would not come in. On 9 April 1951, Truman asked for recommendations at a critical meeting. Bradley, Acheson, Harriman, and Marshall agreed. Get rid of him. And on 11 April, Truman fired MacArthur. Existential deterrence began as soon as the bomb was first dropped. Stalin was deterred from the time the first bomb was dropped on 6 August 1945, and he moved quickly to acquire his own nuclear bombs. Truman was deterred by a troubled conscience in the sense that the use of nuclear weapons might normalize their use and lead to the destruction of civilization. In his final State of the Union speech at the end of his term in January 1953, Truman said, "War today between the Soviet Empire and the free nations might dig the grave not only of our Stalinist opponents, but of our own society as well as theirs. The war of the future would be one in which man could extinguish millions of lives at one blow, demolish the great cities of the world, and destroy the very structure of civilization. Such a war is not a possible policy for rational men."
So we have now come to our first Q&A section with Dr. Newman. And I've got some questions here for you, Dr. Newman. Are you ready?
Yep. Can you hear me?
Yep, sure can.
Okay.
Okay. Our first question comes from Heather Fear. How do you reconcile Truman's presidency with the sign he kept on his desk, the buck stops here?
Okay. It's an interesting question. It has a little history to it. The origin of the phrase itself, the buck stops here, was a wooden sign that Truman received as a gift from a prison warden who, like Truman, was an avid poker player. Truman kept the sign on his desk in the Oval Office to declare that he accepted ultimate responsibility for the decisions he made. However, we should consider these points. It's a hell of a bad thing for the buck to stop on the desk of someone who doesn't know what in the hell's going on. If the buck stops where he kills hundreds of thousands of innocent women and children, that's terrible. If the buck stops on the desk of the guy who replaces the OSS with a Nazi Galen organization, that is terrible. In the beginning, because President Truman had no idea what he was doing, he accepted some terrible proposals from his closest advisors. But in the end, these things tortured his conscience. Let's move on.
All right. Our next question comes from Alan Dale. It says, you mentioned that Volume 3, Into the Storm, changed your view of Eisenhower. Can you speak about how you now reconcile Ike's parting speech on the military-industrial complex with his plans to assassinate foreign leaders?
Okay, we're in Section 7 now. That's pertaining to Section 7. And so I think what we'll do, if you can hold that question, we can start there with that one when we come back on live.
Okay. Well,
anything else on Section 6 on the Truman years?
Well, let's see. I see here it says from Bill Simpage, are you saying that Marshall denied the funds because he wanted Mao's forces to unify China?
Yeah, actually, not just Marshall. That was the policy of the White House at the time. They just didn't feel like they wanted to get involved in the war. They, as I said, they had reduced our military forces a huge amount. And so they took a calculated gamble. So it wasn't just Marshall. That was a consensus.
Okay. We have a question here, and I know we want to stick with what we just saw, but we did have something that come up that we were going to circle back to yesterday, and it comes from Greg Malkoff. And he says, first off, great presentation yesterday. Do you feel Operation Gladio was perhaps the real operational force at ground level in Dealey Plaza with anti-Castro Cubans and the Mafia used as false cover? That's his question. What's your insight on that?
Well, it's obviously a good question. I've been pondering it and researching it for the last 4 years. I think we're making some excellent progress since Heather's transcribing a lot of the Gladio stuff has been made available now. But I would have to say that it really, what we should expand this just a little bit to say what happened when President Kennedy unwisely appointed Lenitzer as the Supreme Allied Commander of Europe in the middle of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Lenitzer, after all, had been involved in arming the Gladio units way back in 1947 and 48. So
So he knew all about that. JFK did not know what he was sending him to. So the question arises, since they're basically assassins and saboteurs and criminals, and they're, as I mentioned yesterday, being run by two clandestine committees under NATO, whether or not, when we consider the assassination in Dealey Plaza, that the Lenditzer's access to these same assassins was how important that might have been and what happened in Dealey Plaza. So I think that there's a lot more well beyond that. I like to think about when we talk about the murder of someone, whoever it is, including the president, the classic analytic paradigm of motive, means, and opportunity. And so I think that motive, the origin of the motive goes back to the Bay of Pigs. And the means, I look at what's going on in 62 as a present, really, from the Kennedy brothers, who unwisely walked right back into an attempt to overthrow Castro again. When they end up with Operation Northwoods in the fight between Lenditzer and the president. So there's a lot of reasons why Kennedy's enemies don't like him. And in the Cuban Missile Crisis, Kennedy will not play ball, even though they backed him up against the wall. By something which we'll talk about in Section 8, I'm going to kind of hold back on that right now because it's an interesting part of Section 8. I'd like the audience to hear it first. But in any event, I'll end my response with this. The most that it could have done, the Gladio units with respect to Dealey Plaza, would have been to, in 62, to opened up some opportunities, some options in the opportunities to do the deed. But there's a whole lot more going on there. I'll just mention one thing. Besides all the things that they hated Kennedy for, the one that really had them scared the most is by the time we get to the end of 62, they know he's going to win the reelection on one reason only. The economy is roaring. Everybody's going to get tax breaks. And so they're facing not only all the things they don't like about them, but they're going to have to put up with them for another 4 years. And so that has something to do with timing. But anyway, I think I better stop now. That's a long answer to a short question. It kind of spans a lot of different things.
Okay. We have another question here from this one actually comes from Casey Quinlan. Is there a time when you felt that Truman ever knew what was going on?
Yeah. Okay. So I think soon after the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombings, he began to get worried. But it wasn't really until a few years later, that quote that I gave you a few minutes ago, where he really talks about, look, we can't do this. This is not even a military weapon. It's taking out all these innocent women and children. We can't do that as civilized men. So really, I think he gets it towards the end of his first term. He had two terms, as you know. So we'll say, 45, 46, around in there. And he changes his tune. Yeah. So I think it's around there that he really, it just eats him up.
Okay. I have a question here from Doug Horn, and he says that he thinks that you might have skipped slide 16 in Truman Part B presentation, and he wants to know if you could put that slide up, which I have available if you'd like me to.
Yeah, go ahead and put that up. I saw that up, and I don't know what, it seems like it jumped.
Okay, let me go ahead and put that up on the screen.
Yeah, that's the beginning of his long-range plan. Yeah, that was the slide that we missed over.
Okay, let me pull that up on the screen.
Yeah. I'll just leave myself unmuted and so I can comment on it.
Correct, yeah. Let me put this up here.
So okay. MacArthur recalled, this is about the time, you know, where the Chinese came in. And, you know, his Willoughby is saying there's only, you know, a few of them. And MacArthur's pretending like they're that's all there is, but they got their butts kicked. So then he began to formulate this new plan, new long-range plan for destroying the Chinese forces in Korea. He said, my decisive objective would be to cut their supply lines. I would then clear the enemy rear all across the top of North Korea by massive air attacks. If I were still not permitted to attack the massed enemy reinforcements across the Yalu or to destroy its bridges, I would sever Korea from Manchuria by laying a field of radioactive wastes, the byproducts of atomic manufacture, all across major lines of enemy supply. The destruction of North Korea had left it bereft of supplies. Now, if you go to the next slide, there was one more that got missed. This hit the next slide, 17. And I read this. This is the plan continues. And go to the next one. I think that's going to be Bradley. And then one more. Go to 19. No, there's one missing. Another senior military officer condemned the whole idea of putting these nuclear wastes up there, because how would the Koreans live afterwards, even if they won? So it was crazy. He was a legend in his own narcissistic mind by that point, defying all the orders that he had been given by the president. And the amazing thing is the Joint Chiefs were even kind of scared to straighten him out. They knew that he was out of his mind, and so did Truman. So you have to ask the question, why did they wait so long for so many people to die, including Americans that didn't need to die if he had just followed his orders? And I say it's the hubris of people as famous as that who think that they are larger than the gods, and they expect everybody to do exactly what they say, even if they disagree with them. And if they disagree with them, he's unmercifully critical of people, including the president. And that's why they had to fire him. But they waited way too long to fire MacArthur. So I think did we take care of business, Doug? Okay.
Okay. Looks like I have one last question here that's in our chat log. This is from Monty, and it's a statement and a question, it looks like. It says, I noticed that Major John Newman made a reference to the Berlin blockade crisis. It should be noted that the bulk Marshall Plan funds were being siphoned in Operation Gladio covert actions directly from the Cooperation Administration's office in Paris, France, which was under the control of W. Averill Harriman, partner in the Nazi-infested Wall Street firm of Brown Brothers Harriman. Lane-born M. Williams, president of Freeport Sulfur, a CIA front company, and CIA agent E. Howard Hunt, the CIA crip for siphoning ECA funds into Operation Gladio terrorist operations with ZR Candy. And it says he'd like to have you, he wants to gauge your response on that.
Well, all he's got to do is read, the section on trading with the enemy. We went over all that stuff, and it's up there to view. And so I wouldn't disagree with anything he's saying. We have almost 90% of it as it is, and because time is wasting here, I think the best thing would be for him to go back and check out what we have on this briefing that we did last night.
Okay, and for anybody that hasn't already seen part one of our first evening, it's not really part one, but it was our first evening, please go back and rewatch it again, because I know sometimes we do kind of glaze over a little bit, so it's great to go back and polish up on it. I don't see any more questions in the comment section at the moment, Dr. Newman, so if you're ready to go, we can roll the last section of our
presentation. Yeah, let's do it. Let's get, because this is, we're getting to the real meat of things right now.
Okay, well, give me just a minute, and I will get it up on the screen.
I'll mute.
I now turn to Section 7. Section 7 deals with President Eisenhower's administration. There are two parts, and Part 1, which I will cover now, deals with the coup in Iran, NATO and the European Defense Community, and Eisenhower and the H-bomb. With NATO in place and an armistice in Korea, the battleground for the Cold War had shifted to the so-called Third World. Eisenhower and Dulles believed the free world was being challenged in Latin America, the Middle East, Africa, and Asia. Eisenhower used the CIA more actively than Truman had. Ike believed the agency would become one of America's chief weapons in the Cold War. One thing Ike did not brag about was the overthrow of Iranian Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh. Ike was pleased with the outcome, but didn't want it discussed because he felt the CIA's feat should be kept secret and deniable. Iranian Prime Minister Mossadegh had seized the Anglo-Persian Oil Company and broken diplomatic relations with London. In the spring of 1953, Foreign Secretary Anthony Eden came to Washington to propose a joint effort between Britain's MI6 and the CIA to topple Mossadegh. Eisenhower was receptive. Planned in the early summer of 1953 by Director of Central Intelligence Allen and Foster Dulles, Secretary of State, Operation Ajax sought to depose Mossadegh and bring the Shah back to power. Ajax needed the president's approval. Throughout his presidency, Eisenhower was always careful to leave no paper trail of his role in any coup, but he was kept informed of them by Foster Dulles. Ajax succeeded. Mossadegh was arrested, and the Shah returned. He gave the United States 40% of Iran's oil, and Ike gave $85 million in aid to Iran. Everyone was happy, except for Iran's people and some British oil executives who lost their monopoly. On 31 July 1953, Senate Majority Leader Robert Taft died from cancer. That was a blow to Eisenhower, with whom Taft had worked closely. William Nolan, who replaced Taft, was opposed to any foreign involvement except the Chinese nationalists. In his diary, Eisenhower wrote of Nolan, "How stupid can you get?" Eisenhower was adamant about building a, quote, United States of Europe, unquote. Germany would be rearmed, unified, and brought into NATO and the European Defense Community as a full partner. Eisenhower hoped the EDC would provide greater security for the West, a smaller defense establishment for the United States, and lower taxes. On 12 August 1953, EDC ratification received a boost when the USSR successfully tested a hydrogen bomb. At an 8 October news conference, Ike said that the Soviets now possess a stockpile of atomic weapons, and that their capability to attack us with these arms will increase with the passage of time. Ike added that the U.S. strength in atomic weapons was increasing steadily, but warned that this titanic force must be reduced to the fruitful service of mankind. Some top advisors were firmly opposed. Foster Dulles had no faith whatsoever in any disarmament proposal. He believed in dealing with the Russians only from a position of overwhelming strength. Foster Dulles insisted that various Soviet proposals so far received for disarmament were merely propaganda devices designed to weaken NATO and to discourage the French from ratifying EDC. Louis Strauss, chairman of the AEC, agreed with Dulles. Eisenhower declared he was prepared to meet with the Soviets. He announced that the four-power talks the Russians had requested would begin promptly to discuss such problems as an Austrian treaty, Korea, Germany, and disarmament. Eisenhower received unusual applause when he told the United Nations that the U.S. was ready to devote its entire heart and mind to find the way by which the miraculous inventions of man shall not be dedicated to his death, but consecrated to his life. A standing ovation. but the Russians stalled. They gave no immediate response, nor did they respond during the next year or the next. A great opportunity was lost. Eisenhower's Adams for Peace proposal was probably the most generous and serious offer for controlling the arms race ever made by an American president. Still, the Russians were not interested. They let the numbers frighten them. The United States might get 2,000 or 3,000 bombs ahead of them. In this way, the logic of the nuclear arms race takes over. It was a logic unique to itself, with no connection to experience or reality. Most everyone agreed that the sole purpose of making atomic weapons was to deter the enemy from aggression. Eisenhower was unhappy with the failure of the Russians to respond to the Atoms for Peace program. He concluded that he had no choice but to become fully committed to the H-bomb. Ike was not itching to use these weapons. Rather, he felt he needed lots of them to deter Russian and Chinese aggression. His solution, the essence of the great equation, was to rely a lot more on the nuclear bomb. The bombs became the centerpiece of his strategy and of his defense policy. It allowed him to cut spending while increasing America's nuclear lead. It made possible his New Look program, as the Pentagon's public relations people called it. Fewer conventional forces and more atomic firepower at less cost. The basic structure of the New Look program was an expanded strategic air force and a much reduced conventional force on land and at sea. It depended upon a huge American lead in nuclear weapons. Critics charged that it was unbalanced and thereby forced America into an all-or-nothing posture. The critics were right, but in a mid-January speech, Secretary of State Dulles made it clear when he announced that Eisenhower and the NSC had made a, quote, basic decision about future Soviet aggression. Eisenhower ordered Foster Dulles to make his speech on the strategy of massive retaliation. Dulles announced it was a strategy to use nuclear weapons for instant retaliation by means and at places of our own choosing. Based on a March 1954 National Security Council paper signed by Eisenhower, a top secret Joint Chiefs document declared, quote, in a general war, atomic weapons will be used at the outset. Any armed conflict that pitted American and Soviet forces directly against one another would be, from the first salvos, a nuclear war. Any armed Soviet incursion into territory deemed vital to U.S. interests, even a tentative crossing of the East-West German border, would spark an instant all-out nuclear response. In late 1955, the Army Chief of Staff, General Matthew Ridgway, remained opposed to massive retaliation. A decorated officer in World War II and commander of the 8th Army in Korea, Ridgway resigned in protest. His successor, General Maxwell Taylor, another commander in those wars, also aroused his staff to mount one more round of resistance to the idea of this massive nuclear war right at the beginning of any war that happens. In a draft of the following year's JCS war plan, known as the Joint Strategic Capabilities Plan, Taylor tried to insert language suggesting that the military might refrain from using nuclear weapons in smaller wars that were more geographically confined than general war. When JCS Chairman Radford found out about Taylor's plan, he sent a critical memo to all of the Joint Chiefs and complained about Taylor to President Eisenhower. Eisenhower calmly reminded his old Army friend that it was official U.S. policy to base all military planning on the use of nuclear weapons without restriction at the outset of any war with the Soviet Union. Taylor argued that even the use of small nuclear weapons would trigger escalation to general war. Eisenhower waved away the concern and held his ground. Taylor was confused and angry. Still, for all his calm and confidence, Eisenhower was conflicted about the nuclear era. By this time, the Soviets had built their own atomic arsenal and a fleet of aircraft with a range to drop bombs on American soil. One takeaway from this is that Taylor is not going to survive to the end of Eisenhower's term. He's going to have to go. Interestingly, on 1 July 1956, the president and his national security advisors heard a briefing from the Super Secret National Security Council Net Evaluation Subcommittee, NES, on the consequences of a nuclear war between the U.S. and the USSR. The results were grim for both sides. The USSR was destroyed as a society. The U.S. government was wiped out. Its economy was in near total collapse, and 66% of its population was sick without care. Eisenhower was visibly shaken by the briefing. He concluded the only way to keep the U.S. safe was to have a powerful deterrent, and that meant a mighty nuclear arsenal. If deterrence failed, Ike would rely on General LeMay to find a way how to respond. As commander of the Strategic Aircraft Air Force Command, the most powerful armada of planes in history, LeMay decided that the quickest way to destroy the Soviet war machine was to destroy the Soviet Union, especially its large cities, where the political leaders and military commanders and factory workers lived. LeMay had already written his own ticket, labeled the Strategic Air Command Emergency War Plan 149. It called for slamming the Soviet Union with the entire stockpile of atomic bombs in a single massive attack. It meant dropping 133 A-bombs on 70 cities within 30 days. In this deed, the B-36 bomber was one of the ways that he was going to accomplish that. From 1949, the year of Sack's first war plan, to the spring of 1955, the list of targets grew 14-fold and continued to grow each year through the end of the decade. On 15 March 1954, Navy Captain Brighton Moore attended the Strategic Air Command nuclear war briefing and wrote about it. The plan by 1954 was horrendous compared to the 1949 plan. LeMay's new Sunday punch, as he called it, would deliver between 600 and 750 nuclear bombs in less than one day, using B-36s and B-47s. In April 1959, Eisenhower approved the deployment of two United States Air Force Jupiter intermediate-range ballistic missile squadrons in Italy and one in Turkey. Between February and July 1961, 30 missiles were deployed at 10 sites in Italy, and 15 missiles were deployed in Turkey. United States Air Force personnel retained control of arming the warheads. These missiles were largely obsolete by the time they were installed. They were removed in April 1963 as a backdoor trade for the earlier removal of the Soviet medium-range ballistic missiles from Cuba to end the 1960 Cuban Missile Crisis. All right, now I'm going to turn to the Eisenhower administration, part two. Section 7, part two deals with the communist victory in Vietnam and the 1954 Geneva Accords and Eisenhower's plan to overthrow Castro, Patrice Lumumba, and Trujillo in the Dominican Republic. And so in the summer of 1954, Eisenhower dealt with a serious French problem in Vietnam. Undersecretary of State Walter Bettel Smith was the U.S. representative at the Geneva Conference. The Viet Minh, the Chinese assistants, had just defeated the French at the Dien Bien Phu, 13 March to 7 May 1954. The Fourth French Republic had proved unable to make effective decisions regarding decolonization of the numerous remaining French colonies, including French Indochina and Algeria. France appealed to Eisenhower to intervene, if necessary, with nuclear weapons. The president refused. During the Geneva Conference, held between 26 April and 20 July, the communists were stalling while the Vietnam Viet Minh were regrouping to strike the French again. The Director of Central Intelligence, Alan Dulles, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff told Eisenhower that he should attack the Chinese. He lectured them on how that would require carrying out an atomic strike against the air bases and ports in mainland China, coupled with a preventive nuclear strike against Russia. Eisenhower refused to intervene. The Viet Minh didn't really need any more help from China anyway. On 21 July, the Geneva Agreements established a ceasefire, a partition of Vietnam, and called for nationwide elections within 2 years. That would never happen. The French defeats in Vietnam and Algeria would cause the fall of the French Fourth Republic. At that time, in the spring of 1954, the question of preventive war was put to Eisenhower generally for review. A Joint Chiefs of Staff Advanced Study Group proposed that the United States, quote, deliberately precipitate war with the USSR in the near future before the USSR could achieve a large enough thermonuclear capability to be a real menace to the continental U.S. Army Chief of Staff Matthew Ridgway denounced the proposal. He told the president that, quote, this was contrary to every principle upon which our nation had been founded. Eisenhower concluded the debate in late 1954 by issuing an updated basic national security policy statement. He said, quote, the United States and its allies must reject the concept of preventive war or acts intended to provoke war. And now I want to turn to a very disturbing story that I was not really prepared for, but Eisenhower's covert action plan for Cuba, and specifically ordering the murder of heads of state. Alan Dulles, once told by Eisenhower what he wanted, was joking around one day with government and business leaders in Miami. He said that Castro had to be removed from power. Well, Nixon's sycophant William Pauley was there at the meeting, and he said he had men prepared to eliminate Castro for a price, meaning assassinate him, of course. Well, a CIA memo afterwards said Dulles, quote, jokingly remarked that he would turn this over to his assassination department. That remark was removed in its entirety from the CIA summary of the meeting just 2 days later. Alan Dulles liked to talk tough, but he was not eager to step into the Stygian River of assassination. Dulles quickly found out that killing Castro was no joke. Eisenhower was angry with Dulles, had been for quite a while, for not reporting the extent of Castro's communist ties back in 1959. In March 1960, Eisenhower approved a covert action program to remove Castro. And in the fall of 1960, Eisenhower would end up having to browbeat Dulles into directing assassinations of foreign heads of state. Eisenhower pressed Dulles for Castro's overthrow, and he chastised the DCI for proposing pointless sabotage operations. In the historic 18 August 1960 White House meeting on Cuba, Eisenhower expanded the covert plan to get rid of Castro. In a separate national security session that same day, Eisenhower ordered, to the astonishment of everybody in this meeting, the assassination of Congo's Prime Minister Lumumba. Eisenhower's ruthless strategy became the unimaginable centerpiece of my Volume 2, Countdown to Darkness. That was a book that changed my view of President Eisenhower. I was incredulous that the same president that warned America about the military-industrial complex, we all know about that. What we didn't know was that he wanted a Cold War triple murder play. In search of Organization of American States, the OAS, support for his plan to overthrow Castro, Eisenhower perpetually pressured Dulles to get rid of Dominican President Rafael Trujillo. And in order to secure NATO support for his Cuban policy, Eisenhower ordered Dulles to arrange the assassination of Congolese Prime Minister Patrice Lumumba. As Eisenhower's Cuban triple play unfolded, he demanded that everybody had to pretend they didn't know about it. But when JFK learned about the CIA plan, and he did, a brawl erupted over the Cuban crisis in the fall 1960 Nixon-Kennedy presidential debates. JFK was able to pummel Nixon for not standing up to Castro and not arming the rebels inside and outside of the island, while Nixon, who knew that's exactly what they were doing, was unable to respond due to the covert nature of the plan. Ever since March 1960, Eisenhower's plan to overthrow Castro held that a CIA-trained exile invasion in Cuba would trigger an internal uprising of the Cuban people. But by the fall of that same year, that part of the plan ended up being foolish. On 3 November 1960, in a crucial secret meeting of the special group, now that included the Pentagon, the State Department, and Eisenhower's National Security Advisor, the group candidly dismissed an internal uprising as myth. Castro's agents in Cuba had, with Soviet tutelage, successfully penetrated all the underground groups, dooming any chance an exile landing would ignite an internal uprising. Any invasion by the United States would be met by a hostile population. Yet, CIA's Deputy Director of Plans, Richard Bissell, deliberately lied to JFK before his inauguration, saying that the invasion would trigger an internal uprising. The final years of Eisenhower's presidency occurred in the context of the dangerous quickening of the Cold War. From December 1959 to April 1961, the race as the Cuban invasion was getting ready to take place. At the same time, the race for a long-term delivery system for nuclear weapons came to its final, unexpected, and unstable conclusion. The so-called missile gap favored the United States, not the Soviet Union. So the inevitable consequence of Castro's revolution played itself out by early 1961. As communism established itself successfully, armed to the teeth by the Soviet bloc a few miles from the American underbelly, and like a runaway train, the darkness that descended on Cuba in 1961 after the Bay of Pigs disaster would descend far more dangerously on the world in 1962 with the Cuban Missile Crisis. And so in the fall of 60, under pressure from a desperate Eisenhower to get rid of Castro, Dulles approved the CIA's use of the mafia to assassinate Fidel Castro. Terrible decision. As Eisenhower's triple play unfolded, the Democratic and Republican nominees had entered the election campaign. In the National Security Council, as I said before, the president had demanded that everybody had to be prepared to swear an oath that he has not heard of it. The Cuban invasion, that is. But the Nixon-Kennedy debates turned into a spectacle over the crisis. And unfortunately for the vice president, Kennedy had heard all about it. All of this came together in a terrible ending. The covert CIA paramilitary plan was unable to keep pace with the consolidation of the regime in Havana. That plan breathed its last death gurgle before President Kennedy was inaugurated. And it didn't take long for Alan Dulles and the Joint Chiefs of Staff to figure out if they told the president the truth about Cuba and Laos, he would have boarded Cuba and negotiate over Laos. So they lied over and over again to keep their war plans in play. They thought that they could pull it off. They could get Kennedy to do it. They were wrong. Dulles and the Joint Chiefs unethically assumed that when the exile invasion force was being slaughtered on the beachhead at the Bay of Pigs, the president would have to change his mind and send in the Marines and the Air Force. But with a big lie about Cuba, that the brigade could succeed and the Cuban people would rise up in rebellion against it, didn't work. The countdown to darkness came to its tragic and ignominious end. Like a geological fault. Once past that foreboding event horizon, political and economic forces inexorably cleaved inward like matter pulled into the singularity of a black hole. The Rubicon had been crossed, There was no going back, no way to go back. There was only going forward into the storm of Armageddon. Now we arrive at the last section, section 8, and it's the finale to volume 4, Armageddon. It sets the stage after all these years to volume 5, the title of which is The Watchman Waketh in Vain. Section 8 deals with President Kennedy's administration. It has three parts, A, B, and C. I will begin now with part A. The Kennedy administration, the manipulation of JFK. This extract from Kennedy's inaugural address was composed by economist John Kenneth Galbraith. To those people in the Hudson villages of half the globe struggling to break the bonds of mass misery, we pledge our best efforts to help them help themselves for whatever period is required. Not because the communists may be doing it, not because we seek their votes, but because it is right. So let us begin anew, remembering on both sides that civility is not a sign of weakness and sincerity is always subject to proof. Let us never negotiate out of fear, but let us never fear to negotiate. In the 10 days between Kennedy's inauguration and his 2 February 1961 State of the Union speech, he said that he and the country were sailing into a storm more perilous than he had at first anticipated. Quote, "No man entering upon this office could fail to be staggered upon learning the harsh enormity of the trials through which we must pass in the next 4 years. As weapons spread and hostile forces grow stronger, I must inform the Congress that in each of the principal areas of crisis, the tide of events has been running out and time has not been our friend." Kennedy's presidency began with a rude awakening. Director of Central Intelligence Alan Dulles and Deputy Director of Plans, Richard Bissell, lied to him about the alleged uprising that would take place behind the lines that would follow the exile landings at the Bay of Pigs. Afterwards, Robert Kennedy recalled, "We kept asking when the uprisings were going to take place." Of course, no uprisings did take place. Secretary of State Rusk recalled, "It was believed that the uprising was utterly essential to success." National Security Advisor of the President Bundy recalled, "Success in this operation was always understood to be dependent upon an internal human reaction." As I noted in the previous section, both Dulles and Bissell knew there would be no uprising. Along with the JCS, they were certain Kennedy would have to change his mind and intervene once the exiles were being slaughtered on the beachhead. Well, they were wrong. The key factor in Kennedy's decision not to intervene in Laos was his growing dissatisfaction with the Joint Chiefs resulting from the disastrous Cuban invasion at the Bay of Pigs. Kennedy looked upon the Cuban failure as a lesson well learned. He told his aide Schlesinger, "If it hadn't been for Cuba, we might be about to intervene in Laos." Waving a sheaf of cables from Lemitzer, he added, "I might have taken this advice seriously." His speechwriter Sorensen recalled that Kennedy said, "Thank God for the Bay of Pigs happened when it did. Otherwise, we'd be in Laos by now. That would be 100 times worse." Kennedy's growing antipathy towards the Joint Chiefs was masked by their growing irritation with him. General LeMay, Air Force General LeMay, was particularly unhappy with JFK. General Lemitzer similarly deplored JFK's tendency to waste time in quibbling over policy. As the president had to ponder what to do about South Vietnam, he found himself in a terrible situation, pitted against his own military advisors. I love this photograph. Lemnitzer is in the bottom right-hand corner. This is the point at which Kennedy sent him over to become the Supreme Allied Commander of Europe. Lemnitzer didn't like that, and he didn't like Kennedy. Look at the look on his face and Kennedy's reaction. Also take a look at the guy behind Lemnitzer's right shoulder. That's Maxwell Taylor. He gets to take over. He's got a smirk on his face. He's getting ready to take over as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Priceless picture. The struggle over sending U.S. combat troops to Vietnam that erupted in April 1961 continued unabated, parallel to the concomitant nuclear-tinged Berlin crisis and with growing domestic racial unrest. Kennedy pushed aside all the calls from the Joint Chiefs to send combat troops to Vietnam. Kennedy was upset by the intense pressure for U.S. intervention there, and he decided he had to act. So in October 1961, Kennedy sent General Taylor to Vietnam with orders to return with a recommendation against sending U.S. combat troops to Vietnam. General Taylor returned with a strange proposal to send 8,000 U.S. combat troops to Vietnam under a flood release task force cover. Shocked and angry, Kennedy tried to recall all copies of the final report. Kennedy even planted false stories in the newspapers that implied Taylor had not endorsed sending U.S. combat troops. On 26 November 1961, in what became widely known as the Thanksgiving Massacre between 26 and 29 November, Kennedy finally got around to putting the interventionists out to pasture. The personnel changes that took place at the CIA and State Department happened in the wake of JFK's crucial decision on Vietnam. National Security Action Memorandum 111, promulgated on 22 November 1961, exactly 2 years to the day of Kennedy's murder in Dallas, Texas. For President Kennedy, General Taylor's proposal was the last straw. In the intense debate that followed, the key meeting occurred on 15 November 1961. Kennedy asked Lemnitzer how he could justify this proposal for going into Vietnam while at the same time ignoring Cuba. Lemnitzer was blunt and impudent. He replied that the JCS felt that even at this point, the U.S. should go into Cuba. With NSAM 111 pictured on the right of your screen there, JFK drew a line in the sand on Vietnam. It contained no combat troops, and it contained no guarantees to save Vietnam from communism. On the other hand, Kennedy did agree to a significant increase in American advisors and equipment, but he would not go beyond this commitment at any point during the rest of his presidency. We know from the Berlin crisis that President Kennedy was willing to go to war for the right reason, and that for him, getting mired down in Vietnam could lead to a much bigger war in Europe. And that really tells us how significant Kennedy's Vietnam decision was. He turned down combat troops not when the decision was clouded by ambiguities and contradictions in the reports from the battlefield, but when the battle was unequivocally desperate, when all concerned agreed that Vietnam's fate hung in the balance, and when his principal advisors told him that vital U.S. interests in the region and the world were at stake. What the chiefs were proposing didn't make any sense. Before Berlin became a crisis in June 1961, the Joint Chiefs of Staff had been pushing for U.S. military intervention in Cuba, Laos, and Vietnam, all in the space of a couple of months. Kennedy was stunned to find out that U.S. ground forces were barely sufficient for Cuba. Fighting there and in Southeast Asia at the same time made no military sense. Soviet strategy actually sought to lure the U.S. into intervention in Cuba in order to expose the prize of West Berlin. When the Berlin crisis was over, Vietnam filled the same function of tying down the U.S. forces and exposing the prize of West Berlin. MacArthur would have fallen into the same trap had he got what he wanted, going to war with China back in 1950. So all of this poses two really crucial questions. Here's the first one. What did the Joint Chiefs know that made them so sure they could fight on multiple fronts, let alone just one, without handing Berlin to Khrushchev? There's only one answer to that. A preemptive, massive nuclear strike to destroy the Soviet Union. But here's the second question. How would the Joint Chiefs maneuver JFK to go along with this? We need to consider that when the overwhelming superiority of American strategic power was exposed by the ending of the Berlin crisis, Khrushchev then played his last card to capture West Berlin. And that was the placement of medium-range and intermediate-range nuclear missiles in Cuba. But here's the thing. The Joint Chiefs knew very early on that the missiles were coming, and they said nothing at all about it to President Kennedy. I will tell you why in Part C of this section. All right, now I move to Section 8, Part B, the Kennedy administration. JFK takes off the gloves. In November 1961, just before Kennedy drew a line in the sand on Vietnam, he had done the same thing on Berlin. Previously, the April Bay of Pigs fiasco had convinced Khrushchev to test Kennedy on Berlin. So Khrushchev bullied Kennedy at the June 1961 Vienna summit by again reviving his demands for a treaty to permanently divide Germany. The so-called missile gap favoring the USSR was still publicly accepted as Khrushchev threatened war over the what he called the ulcer of West Berlin. At Vienna, JFK ended with the remark, "It's going to be a cold winter." In a 25 July 1961 televised address to the nation, Kennedy warned that the immediate threat to world freedom was in West Berlin. The president said that Soviet ambitions were meeting face-to-face in basic confrontation over Berlin. Quote, "the showcase of liberty and great testing place of Western courage and will since 1945. And so the ulcer of West Berlin was bleeding 1,000 East Germans to the west through Berlin every single day. In July 1961, Khrushchev decided to build a wall in the city. By early September, a formidable, heavily fortified, guarded, and booby-trapped cement barrier was erected. Kennedy thought the border closure was actually a good turning point. Privately, he said, "It's not a very nice solution, but a wall is a hell of a lot better than a war." Nevertheless, the Berlin crisis continued to escalate. Khrushchev continued his boasting, while President Kennedy quietly focused on U.S. military preparations. By the fall of 1961, large numbers of American and Russian ground forces were on the move to Berlin. The Berlin crisis had evolved into the most dangerous flashpoint for a nuclear conflict in the long history of the Cold War. While Khrushchev knew his missile threats were bluffs, Kennedy had been careful not to give up, publicly or to the Russians, what he had known since early 1961, that the Soviet ICBM force was almost non-existent. After numerous failures, the first successful Corona spy satellite mission was flown on 18 August 1960. And by the time President Kennedy was inaugurated in early 1961, he knew that the race for a long-range delivery system for nuclear weapons had come to its final, unexpected, and unstable conclusion. There was a missile gap, all right, but it heavily favored the United States, not the Soviet Union. The Berlin crisis unfolded quickly in June 1961 as Khrushchev's bellicose saber-rattling continued. And so, on 13 July 1961, just 12 days before his televised warning about Berlin, JFK decided he needed to chair a crucial National Security Council meeting on nuclear war planning. The 13 July meeting was private and very interesting. Kennedy wanted to hear from his national security advisor, McGeorge Bundy, and his military aide, General Maxwell Taylor, about preparing for, quote, war plans which would permit a discriminating use of nuclear weapons, unquote. Kennedy was not prepared to launch the massive, surprise, all-out, indiscriminate nuclear attack against the USSR and China that Lemnitzer would recommend on 20 July, just a few days later. At that large meeting of the National Security Council's Net Evaluation Subcommittee, NES, Kennedy got up and walked out in disgust. He said, and we call ourselves the human race. RAND Corporation whiz kid Henry Rowan and Bundy's deputy Carl Kazin spent all of August working on the highly selective Kennedy plan with assistance from a few officers in the Pentagon's air staff. So on 5 September, Kazin sent copies of his 33-page final draft to Taylor, Bundy, and Rowan. He criticized the Net Evaluation Subcommittee's Single Integrated Operational Plan for Nuclear War, PSYOP, saying it would kill 54% of the Soviet Union's population and destroy 82% of its industrial infrastructure, which would then lead the USSR to retaliate against the cities of the United States and Europe. Kazin proposed that the United States must be ready to initiate general war by our own first strike instead of planning for a strategy of massive retaliation. Kazin said our goal should be to seek the smallest number of targets, focus on the USSR's long-range striking ability, and avoid Soviet casualties and damage to civilians. He said also the U.S. should maintain a sizable fraction of its nuclear force in a reserve to deter the Soviets from using their surviving forces against U.S. cities. The mounting intelligence from the Discoverer reconnaissance flights showed that using just 55 U.S. bombers to destroy 88 Soviet targets would eliminate the nuclear threat to the United States sufficiently to permit follow-on attacks for other targets. Kazin told a few officials about his counterforce study. Some with backgrounds were skeptical, while those with little knowledge were appalled. Kennedy aide Ted Sorensen told Kazin, "You're crazy. Guys like you shouldn't even be around here." But the president found the paper intriguing. On 13 September, Lemnitzer briefed the PSYOP 62 plan to JFK again. It was still just another recipe for global catastrophe. And Kennedy asked Lemnitzer, "Why are we hitting all those targets in China? The war didn't start there." Lemnitzer answered impudently, as always, "Because they're in the plan, Mr. President." And so, on 21 October, President Kennedy decided to take off the gloves. On that day, U.S. and Soviet forces entered Berlin. And on that same day, Kennedy ordered Deputy Secretary of Defense Gilpatric to give a public speech to a business meeting in Hot Springs, West Virginia. The speech revealed that the United States had 600 heavy bombers, 6 Polaris submarines with 96 missiles, dozens of intercontinental ballistic missiles, and a large fleet of aircraft carrier strike forces, totaling tens of thousands of nuclear delivery vehicles with multiple warheads. Just to make sure that the Russians got the message, the Department of Defense also publicized the speech. This was the death of the alleged Soviet ICBM lead and a concomitant public display of overwhelming American superiority in the strategic nuclear balance of power. This is a great photograph of the standoff between Russian and American tanks at Checkpoint Charlie at the apex of the Berlin crisis. And so on 25 October 1961, U.S. tanks moved into West Berlin, and for the first time in years, 33 Soviet manned tanks, accompanied by troops, entered the city limits of East Berlin. And for the first time during the Cold War, both sides ended up with 10 tanks with engines running, facing each other at Checkpoint Charlie. The standoff lasted for 16 hours, during which Moscow was made aware that four U.S. missile-firing atomic Polaris submarines were submerged in the North Sea, each with 16 warheads aimed at targets in the Soviet Union. At Checkpoint Charlie that day, the Soviet guard post was talking through the USSR high command to Khrushchev. The U.S. guard post was communicating through the U.S. military in Berlin to JFK, where his brother, RFK, was in touch with the KGB. So the two leaders can converse privately. The next day, JFK privately offered to go easy over Berlin if the USSR removed their tanks first. Khrushchev agreed, and he said later, "I assured my comrades that as soon as we pulled back our tanks, the U.S. would pull back their tanks within 20 minutes. And after the Soviet tanks pulled back, Khrushchev reported, "Just as I expected, it did take only 20 minutes for the Americans to respond." And with that choreographed scene, the 1961 Berlin crisis ended. Kennedy's decision to publicly expose the Soviet Union's stark weakness in nuclear capability worked. After all, it did bring a quick end to the Berlin crisis. But did it really? Did Kennedy realize what his decision had put in train? Think about this. Humiliated, defenseless, and desperate, Khrushchev immediately resolved to change the equation by installing Russian medium-range and intermediate-range nuclear missiles in Cuba. Such a risky move required incredible stealth and secrecy, not only to keep the Americans in the dark, but also, and especially, and even more importantly, keeping his own government in the dark. Khrushchev knew that it was as leaky as a sieve. And so he told only a couple of people who absolutely had to know about it. One of them happened to be a senior officer in the Russian rocket forces. Khrushchev quietly sent him to Cuba to survey and plan. All right, at this time, I'm going to move along to Section 8, Part C. The Kennedy administration, Vietnam, Cuba, and treason. On 27 November 1961, an unusual group of officials were called to a meeting in the White House. Some of them had been fired, and some of them were their replacements. Once JFK entered the room, he vented his frustration over the lack of support for his Vietnam policy. Kennedy declared, "Once policy is decided, people on the spot must support it or get out." And he demanded to know who in the Pentagon would be personally responsible for implementing his program. Obviously, the Secretary of Defense, McNamara, answered, "Myself." And he said, "And L," meaning Lemnitzer. So McNamara takes charge, and he returns to the Pentagon that very night to lay out a plan for Operation Beef Up, many military actions to boost the war effort in South Vietnam. At his first Secretary of Defense conference on 16 December, he set forth three tenets. One, we have great authority from JFK. Two, money is no object. Three, no combat troops will be sent to Vietnam. Military Assistance Command Vietnam, MACV, was created as the subordinate command of CINCPAC, meaning the Commander-in-Chief Pacific. General Taylor's old friend and protege, General Paul Harkins, became the first MACV commander on 2 January 1962. And then came Lemnitzer's most audacious memo to President Kennedy. On 13 January 1962, McNamara got the memo from Lemnitzer, and he sent it to JFK saying he didn't endorse the long and subordinate diatribe that was essentially saying this. Lemnitzer was essentially telling the president, we told you a year ago to send combat troops to Vietnam, but you didn't listen. We've done everything you asked for in your program, and if it fails, we still want to send in combat troops. And if you fail to do it then, it will only make our job more difficult when we have to do it anyway. Insubordinate. As I noted in Part B, Lemnitzer had told JFK that the chief still thought the U.S. should intervene in Cuba too. And I will note below, the reason for fighting all these wars at the same time was merciless. The chiefs expected to carry out massive nuclear strikes. As the first half of 1962 unfolded, Lemnitzer and Kennedy fought each other on both fronts, Vietnam and Cuba. In Vietnam, MACV Commander Harkins, with LBJ's knowledge and behind JFK's back, falsified Viet Cong troop estimates just as had been done by General Willoughby in 1950 for MacArthur on the estimates of Chinese forces in Northern Korea. Meanwhile, the Cuban front had become very active. Having steered clear of the Vietnam trap and having weathered the nuclear-tinged crises in Laos and Berlin, in December 1961, the Kennedy brothers sailed unwisely again into the hazardous waters of Cuba. In the worst decision of his presidency, Kennedy approved Operation Mongoose, an attempt to get even with Castro that would end in disaster. JFK's orders sought to get rid of Castro, quote, short of outright war. The one thing that was off limits was military invasion. RFK was in charge. General Lansdale was chief of operations, and Bill Harvey of the CIA oversaw the agency's role in the whole thing. The whole idea was crazy. Nothing had changed in Cuba that suggested that the same flawed equation that failed in 61 could work this time. On the contrary, by the time Mongoose was implemented at the beginning of 1962, the situation was far worse than it had been in the weeks leading up to the Bay of Pigs fiasco. At the outset of the new program, a CIA memorandum warned the special group about a systemic flaw and Air Force Brigadier General Edward Lansdale's plan for Mongoose. Castro's pervasive informant system, efficient propaganda machine, and military and civil suppression are supported this time by jet fighters, radar, patrol boats, and communications capabilities far beyond the level of April 1961. Furthermore, this wasn't some Eisenhower holdover anymore. They owned it. The Kennedy brothers, lock, stock, and barrel. And it was an opportunity for the opponents, Kennedy's, to tag RFK later on after Kennedy's assassination. Anyway, at the time, the team of Robert Kennedy, Lansdale, and William Harvey got along about as well as fleas at a Lysol convention. In late January 1962, Lansdale, sore that JFK wouldn't let him be with President Diem in Vietnam, began secretly serving as Lemnitzer's stalking horse. In February 1962, General Lemnitzer put a seditious plot into play in the Pentagon. He began covertly preparing officers in the Joint Staff's J1, that's manpower and personnel, J2, that's intelligence, J3, that's operations, and J4, logistics, to invade Cuba against JFK's explicit orders. But this was off the table. This preparation was for Lemnitzer's false flag operation, Northwoods. The Lemaitre's Northwoods plan called for a cover, a deception plan, to be put in place first. And then the U.S. would secretly sink one of its Navy ships at Guantanamo, Cuba, and attack the base. It would kill Cubans fleeing in boats, would stage terror campaigns in Miami and Washington, blow up a drone airliner over Cuba, and blame it all on Castro to trick the American population into approving an American invasion of Cuba. Then the U.S. Marines would, along with the Army, Navy, and Air Forces, invade and occupy Cuba, overthrow Castro and his regime, and suppress any domestic Cuban resistance. On 13 March, Lemaitre put his Operation Northwoods on the table. 3 days later, Kennedy and Lemaitre met face-to-face with perhaps a dozen other officers. A memo written by Lansdale, who had attended this meeting, indicates that Lemaitre briefed JFK on the use of, quote, plausible pretexts for the use of force in Cuba. Then, quote, the president said bluntly that we are not discussing the use of military force, that General Lemaitre might find the U.S. so engaged in Berlin or elsewhere that he couldn't use the contemplated four divisions in Cuba. And with that retort, Operation Northwoods was finished. By 28 February 1962, the Kennedy brothers had discovered that General Lansdale was a stalking horse not just for Lemaitre, but Lemaitre's Northwoods plan. RFK quickly kneecapped Lansdale. Meanwhile, in late 61, after the Berlin crisis, the National Security Agency, their intercepts discovered blank Soviet cargo manifests, bogus port declarations, chatter about tanks, radar, and anti-aircraft guns, and Soviet money and personnel flowing into Cuba. Moreover, in February 62, at the exact time Lemaitre was teeing up Northwoods, NSA sources revealed that a general from the USSR Strategic Rocket Forces had arrived in Cuba. Lemaitre's protege, General Marshall Carter, had become the deputy director of Central Intelligence in April 1962. Later on, in a 16 October meeting with JFK, Carter let slip that the U.S. had imagery of a suspected nuclear warhead storage facility in Beju called Cuba. This imagery was taken in February 1962. That was the exact time that the Russian rocket forces officer was in Cuba. After the 13-day October missile crisis, the CIA discovered that the Beju called facility had indeed become the principal Russian nuclear storage facility in Cuba. These indicators confirmed a comment made to me during the early 1990s in an NSA cafeteria. The missile crisis came up, and my friend Jay said in a matter-of-fact manner, we knew right away that the Russians were going to place the missiles in Cuba. He said that discovery was made at the start of 1962. All right, there's nothing wrong with getting that right. The CIA discovered that the Beju Kol facility had indeed become the principal Russian nuclear storage facility in Cuba. At the end of Part A, I asked this question. How did the JCS think they could maneuver JFK into going along with a massive surprise nuclear strike to destroy the USSR? At the end of Part B, I pointed out that the chiefs knew very early on that the missiles were coming and said nothing about it to JFK. If the chiefs had told JFK what they knew in April 62, the president would have been in a position to stop the Soviet deployment in Cuba. There would have been zero chance of a Kennedy approval for a massive nuclear strike to destroy the USSR. The terrifying key to this U.S. hubris is that the chiefs wanted to wipe Russia off the map. They wanted the Soviet missiles in Cuba. They wanted to prevent JFK from stopping that deployment. They wanted JFK to remain in the dark until the Soviet missiles were installed and close to readiness to be fired. They wanted JFK to be up against the wall. And so, the NSA source for the Russian Rocket Forces officer in February 62. The General Carter revelation about the February 62 imagery of the Beijing Hall warhead storage facility, and the recollection of my NSA friend Jay on NSA's early knowledge of the coming missile deployment, all provide triple independent attestation of Khrushchev's plan and the Joint Chiefs' knowledge about it no later than April 1962. JFK's second worst decision was to extend Lemitzer's term of military service and send him to Europe as the Supreme Allied Commander of Europe. JFK knew nothing about Operation Gladio. Taylor got what he wanted, to be the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and control of Vietnam policy. In the fall of 1963, Taylor would sabotage President Kennedy's withdrawal plan from Vietnam. Although he was fired by Robert Kennedy in October 62, Bill Harvey survived when Deputy Director of Plans Helms sent him to Rome as the station chief in April 1965, the CIA station chief. While there, Harvey endorsed the Gladio strategy of tension, assassination, and sabotage. He's still wrapping up here. In the midst of all this, Oswald returned in May 62. By January 1963, he was dutifully walking around the streets of Dallas, not praising the Soviet Union, but with a placard around his neck that read, Viva Fidel. Before his October 1962 firing by Robert Kennedy, CIA's Bill Harvey had gained control over the so-called defection of Castro's associate, Rolando Covella Secades. One of Harvey's tasks, it turns out, was to make sure he got his arms around Covella so that Castro was alive after Kennedy's death to be included in the blame for the murder. Lemitzer and the chiefs lost their plot to get Kennedy to invade Cuba, and with it, any chance to launch a nuclear strike against the USSR. That strike would have meant not only the destruction of Russia, but also an Armageddon for planet Earth. Kennedy had won the day. He was much loved for saving us all from doom, but not his own. He paid for that and stopping the Vietnam Holocaust with his life. His brother Robert and Dr. King would also be murdered to ensure the Vietnam War continued. This slide is my final words in my presentation tonight. It is vital that we must call out the flaws of our country's leaders, especially when they use lies to trick Americans into going to war. But I want to end my presentation on a positive note and remind my listeners this evening that we have had a great many good leaders, including Army generals. Here are two profound examples well worth dwelling upon. My favorite general was U.S. Army Major General Joseph Alexander McChristian, top left. He was perhaps the finest Army intelligence officer. He worked for Patton in World War II. The finest Army intelligence officer ever to wear the uniform. He was once asked on camera what it means to lie about the enemy in a time of war. Didn't take him any time to respond. And he spoke what was in my heart when he replied, quote, it jeopardizes not only the lives of the soldiers on the battlefield, but also the future liberty of your people at home. And then there's Lieutenant General James Morris Gavin, top right. He was a highly decorated Army officer who commanded the 82nd Airborne Division in World War II. After the deaths of John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy, he said, quote, let us not lay on the dead the blame for our own failures, unquote. Being happy now to take some questions.
Very, very powerful stuff. We are going to move on to the question section, Dr. Newman. Are you ready?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Our first question comes from Doug Horn. Is it true that beginning in 1950, General LeMay was scheming, in parentheses, an event of emergency to obtain nuclear bombs from the Air Force guy with the key without going through the Atomic Energy Commission as required by law, that is, without presidential permission?
Yes, there's no doubt about it. We actually have in a really interesting book, a discussion between LeMay and Birkenau and a couple of others. And also in one or two books, I believe Kaplan's The Bomb discusses that LeMay was just going to go do it on his own. He didn't really care whether the president wanted to or not, depending on the situation. I guess it was at a meeting out at Colorado at the underground bunkers up there. And I forget the person who he told it to. I guess he was the commander there. Kept it to himself. He was so taken aback by it. So that never did get back to Kennedy.
Okay. Our second question also comes from Doug Horn. This question is about your observation that during the 13-day Cuban Missile Crisis in the 16 October 1962 XCOM meeting with JFK, DDCI General Marshall Carter, let it slip that the U.S. had imagery of suspected nuclear warhead storage facility in Bajucal, Cuba, taken back in February 1962, 7 months earlier. Was Carter's remark an inadvertent slip, or was there something else to it?
So it would be so easy for me to speak for about a half hour on this, so I'm going to be very disciplined and just say this. Because General Carter, by the way, who didn't tell DCI McCone a whole lot of stuff, very important thing, because Carter and Lemitzer and top NSA leadership had known about the Bajucal nuclear facility for many months and had not reported it to the White House. It looks like it was not intentional. It was intentional and not a slip. If so, it was probably intended to heighten Kennedy's angst by letting him know that Khrushchev had been working on the secret missile deployment for 8 months. Putting JFK up against the wall was the game, just as it had been in the Bay of Pigs. Remember there that the chiefs had not pounded on Kennedy's desk until after the exile brigade is being slaughtered on the beachhead. So now they were trying to do it again. I suppose maybe because this time they felt that the Kennedys owned it because it was their plan, not an Eisenhower all over. Nevertheless, I think that it not only does it show us in triple independent attestation that this was going on, the Khrushchev was moving quickly right away after the Berlin crisis. It also shows us the extent that they went to hide things from the president and back him up against the wall in the crisis, hoping that they could get what they wanted, which was to wipe out the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China.
All right, let me go back here to the question from Alan Dale, which was covered in Section 7, and says, you mentioned that Volume 3, Into the Storm, changed your view of Eisenhower. Can you speak about how you now reconcile Ike's parting speech on the military-industrial complex with his plans to assassinate foreign leaders?
So the Eisenhower we thought we knew was not the real Eisenhower, it turns out. He thought he could demand complete deniability of all of his orders, no matter how bad they were, and let others take the fall for them. But Ike, too, like Truman, had a troubled conscience later on, but when it was too late. So I'd point out three items here. Only in the end did Eisenhower understand that what he had wrought. Only in the end did he realize his hands were bloodstained from the blood money he gave to NATO and the OAS for his plan to win their support to overthrow Castro. And only in the end did Eisenhower have to live with himself and see the gruesome pictures of the torture and dismemberment of Patrice Lumumba's body, the first democratically elected prime minister of Congo. Now, Kennedy's moment with Jesus came earlier, after a couple of years when he gave the speech at the university and went on TV the next night about civil rights and then went over to Italy to try and make an opening to the left. Unlike Truman, who it took him a few years longer, and of course 8 years for Eisenhower to wake up at the end, only at the very end, and give us that speech. And by complex, if I could just point this out, one of the things I did, as I said, he needed the support of NATO, so he took care of Belgium, which were the people that were in the Congo. And what does the military-industrial complex want? It wants exactly what Ike was giving them, the uranium, the diamonds and all the other precious metals that belonged to the Congo. So he was giving the very things that the military industrial complex needed, and they killed Lumumba to get it. And so it's a hell of a speech at the end of the line, but it's a little bit late, isn't it?
Well, okay. Here's a question from Lee Shepard. Is there any evidence that General Lemenser and Bill Harvey ever crossed paths in Europe?
I looked into that because I'm one of two people actually that have seen all the Lemenser documents at National Defense University. And so there's no doubt that Lemenser went to Italy. But the question is, did he go there between, say, March of 63 and beyond when Kennedy made that trip in June? And I couldn't find anything to substantiate that. It could have been.
Okay. Well, we're getting a lot of great questions coming in. And let's go to the next one here. This is from Jay Harv. Is resolving the Berlin crisis provide a basis for resolving the Cuban Missile Crisis?
It did, in one very important aspect. Look, the way that we got out of the Berlin crisis, besides humiliating Khrushchev by showing him and in front of his own government and the world that he didn't have any power, the United States had a lot of it, but the way it actually happened was the two leaders found a back channel to talk to each other, and they made a deal. And so Kennedy said, you go first, and then I'll go. Now, Khrushchev really didn't have any chance, but Kennedy honored that. And so that was a model for how we got out of the Cuban Missile Crisis in the end, because they made a separate deal, again, using Bobby's KGB guy in a bar somewhere to try and make sense. There were two proposals on the table, and Bobby said, let's just go with this one here because it's better. And why did that work? Because the two leaders had done that before. They had done that before, and if that hadn't been for the fact that they had made an agreement and both sides stuck by it, I don't know that that paradigm would have been as acceptable in 62, in the Cuban Missile Crisis. So I think there's merit to that question.
All right. Our next question comes from Rick McLaughlin. What do you think stopped LBJ administration or Nixon later from going through with a nuclear attack, especially knowing the fate of JFK?
Well, there's a new book by Michael Beschloss that's out, I suppose, the last 9 or 10 months called Presidents of War. And he broke some new ground. He got some documents declassified under the FOIA. So it didn't work in Vietnam. We all know that. And it was a stalemate or get out. And so eventually we did get out. But, you know, General Westmoreland didn't want to do it that way. So, you know, while LBJ is being, you know, given the bad news by the wise men, and he basically decides it's over, that's when General Westmoreland, who was the MACV commander at the time, asked permission to use tactical nuclear weapons to get – rescue our chestnuts in the fire, and LBJ did something good. He said no.
Okay, our next question comes from Beverly. Did JFK's decision to assign Lemenser as Secur place him in the perfect position to carry out JFK's assassination by utilizing Gladio operatives? Did this choice result in merely being one more nail in his coffin, or did it provide for the plotters the ultimate ability to actually accomplish the assassination?
Yeah, this came up a little bit earlier in our presentation, and I spoke about it then. And as I said, this is a question I've been working on for years, and I'm still working on it. So I'm not at the end of my analysis just yet because I keep learning new stuff. But you know, it's motive, means, and opportunity, really. That's how you have to look at this. And so just looking at that one piece doesn't really get you there. I think the best we can do with it is to say, since obviously Lemenser knew about Gladio, and it was familiar with those two clandestine committees, and Kennedy was not. At the very least, and we already have motive and means. Motive was Bay of Pigs. Means was the Kennedy brothers gave it to him by going in after Castro again. But so the sack your appointment and being able to use the Gladio the Gladio option takes us a little bit into opportunity a little bit, but there's a lot more opportunities besides that. It's more complex than that, so I wouldn't rule it out. For example, I'll just give you an example. Something we're looking at. I mean, all of a sudden we've got these guys from Europe, these assassins that are all in Dallas, Dealey Plaza at the same time, and then they're not there either. I think one of the ways you could interpret that, because I think Brian Edwards has given one of the best presentations I've heard on how you do this, how it's a military operation. Now, he knows something about it because he was in a SWAT team. But anyway, one way you could use a lot of those assassins is to flood the zone, send three or four of them in there, confuse everybody. So I'm not finished at all with answering this question, and I may never be able to answer it, but I'm trying. I've been working on it for 4 years, and it's a good question, but that's all I can say tonight.
Okay. Next question comes from Russell Swickard. This might be kind of a hard one here, but it says, how many people besides JFK knew that the U.S. had a 17-to-1 nuclear ballistic edge over the Soviets at the missile crisis?
Oh, everybody did. They put it out in 25 October 1961. And the Pentagon put it, publicized it. It was a speech at Hot Springs, West Virginia, which I went into. So the missile crisis is the next year. So, in fact, the reason that we have the missile crisis is because Khrushchev is so embarrassed and so desperate. The only thing he can do to get any leverage back is to stick those missiles in Cuba because of that knowledge, of that huge favor for the Americans in the strategic nuclear balance pot.
Okay. We have a question from Kip Burns. It says, how has Operation Mongoose been vetted to be truthful and not a planted story to discredit the Kennedys? Are there recordings and documents, and if so, where to find them?
Oh, they're almost all. And see, it's not just Mongoose. You're going to have to get this stuff in the Joint Chiefs of Staff papers. Some of them are Wheeler papers. Some of them, others, I've collected them all. So I – give me – go over that again.
Okay. How has Operation Mongoose been vetted to be truthful and not a planted story to discredit the Kennedys? And then the next part was, are there recordings and documents and where to find
them? Okay, I don't know about recordings or documents, but, it wasn't a plan to discredit the Kennedys. It was a plan to hijack their stupid idea of going after Castro again. It was just a shipwreck to hijack that and back Kennedy up against the wall and force him to do something he didn't want to do, just like they did at the Bay of Pigs. So it's more of a hijacking. It's not, and so Lansdale isn't lying. He starts out by just telling the truth as he sees it, which was not that good. But he very quickly becomes the stalking horse, not just for Lemaitre, but for his Northwoods plan. So by the time we get to the end of the first month in 62, on the 28th of January, Lansdale's already front-loading into Mongoose the Northwoods tasks. And so that's what's going on. That's where it's not lying. It's, he's just trying to get away with it, and he doesn't. The Kennedys see it, kneecap Lansdale right away, and it forces the snake to come out of the grass in the open, and Lemaitre was happy to oblige. And he and Kennedy faced off on 13th March of 1962.
Okay. Our next question comes from Jay Harvey. Did the understanding between JFK and Khrushchev in resolving the Berlin crisis provide a basis for resolving the later Cuban Missile Crisis?
Yeah, we did, we just did that question, right? It did, because
They made a deal. You go first. And it was the same thing in 62. And it worked the first time. So, and it turns out it was a good thing it worked that first time. Even though it was forced, it gave Khrushchev reason to believe that Kennedy would honor pulling out the – all he got in the end, besides removing his own missiles, was the Jupiters. Not just in Turkey, I would say, but also in – there were twice as many in Italy. And so he did. We pulled them out quietly the next year. And so it's too bad, though, that so in both instances, I think this is something I should say. In 61 at the Beifix and in Berlin, not Beifix, in Berlin 61 and the Cuban Missile Crisis 62, you have this quid pro quo where the two leaders don't use their subordinate organizations for obvious reasons because they're all crazy. They want to go to war. Well, you know, what happened in the end is neither JFK nor Khrushchev could actually police their own people afterwards. The deals that they made began to break down. And in the end, Kennedy is assassinated, and Khrushchev isn't assassinated, but he is purged, the only general secretary in the history of the Soviet Union ever to be purged the following year in 64. So both leaders were gone. And, you know, we went bang, slap happy into the Cold War and the Vietnam War, and things were terrible for a long time.
Okay. Next question comes from Patrick McCarthy. Are you aware of any specific information about strategic military-related activities on November 21st or 22nd by any JCS control forces that could have been related to the events in Dallas?
Okay. Yes, I am. But, you know, I say before open mouth, think first. This is a 1963 issue. I am not there yet. I know some things about that, but I always suspect what I know might not be true. I like to have independent attestation. So volume 5 material, we'll see what happens with that one.
Okay. The next question, which touches on that, from Greg Malkoff. When will your fifth volume be coming out, and will it be your last? Also, are you convinced that the JFK and RFK assassinations are decisively linked and involved some of the same forces that descended in Dealey Plaza?
Okay, this is a two-part question. Give me the first part again.
Okay, when will your fifth volume be coming out, and will it be your last?
Okay, so volume 4 we're trying to push out by the end of the year. It's been a long time working on that. If I had to guess, I'd say 2 years, maybe more, maybe 3 years. And the other thing I need to say in conjunction with volume 4, about 3 months after that comes my first MLK book. The title of that is Classified. My Classified.
Well, one more time, give us all the title to volume 5, because that's a really
great question. Yeah, sure. I put that on the table. It's called The Watchman Waketh in Vain. Now, if you own a copy of Volume 3, go to the very end of it, you can see where that came from. But I might as well tell everybody tonight what that is. It's from a psalm in the Old Testament. And the psalm is short. It's just, there's a first part of that. Ere the Lord keepeth the city, the watchman waketh in vain. Now, Kennedy had written that as the opening of his speech he was going to give at the trademark on his way through Dealey Plaza. He never got to say those words because they killed him. But those words show me, anyway, that he was expecting he might die. Because that's what that means. He is the watchman is not keeping his back because the Lord isn't keeping the city. I think that's what he's trying to tell us. Anyway, I like that title. And it's the last thing he would have said had he made it to the trademark. But, you know, I think it's cool because it's from the Old Testament and Kennedy is kind of thinking, I think, about how long he might live, just like Martin Luther King did at the end. He suspected he was going to die too.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, there was a part two to that, so let's ask that.
Okay.
Are you convinced that the JFK and RFK assassinations are decisively linked and involved some of the same forces that descended in Dealey Plaza?
Same forces, probably. It could be a little different. You got to understand here, many years have passed between these assassinations. Here's the way they're linked. Kennedy was trying to avoid an Armageddon, period. And he also wanted nothing to do with what would have been a Holocaust in Vietnam, just getting out of Vietnam. And so no matter whether you say, which was it that was the most important thing, as I said, there are several things that they didn't like about Kennedy. Vietnam was one of them, of course. But when he dies, when he's assassinated, that is where all of a sudden RFK, who was not liked that well, even in the African-American community, all of a sudden, they changed their minds. He changed his ways, and he became a spokesperson for African-Americans. They said, he's white, but he's right. You know, that was one of the things they used to say about RFK. And so MLK was going to come in and run for president in 68. But when Bobby got into the race, he said, fine. You know, he stepped out. So it was the same problem where they saw that Kennedy was going to win the 64 election, and they were going to have to be there for 4 years. They could see that happen. He was going to win California. That's going to put him over the top, and he was going to win that election. Well, they knew that Bobby Kennedy, you know, was going to win, and so they had to, and they got rid of him in sort of the same way. I mean, Dealey Plaza is like, you know, high noon, Wild West stuff in your face, right? And so they killed Kennedy the night of that, you know, when he won the primary, right there was another one of these things to really intimidate, I think. But they had to get rid of Martin first. And so you have two assassinations very close together, only weeks apart. And both of these guys could have, if they were, had lived, could have stopped that damn war. So the link is what Kennedy died for. And as a consequence, Vietnam continued, killed, I think. All right, I'll tell you the second MLK book, what the title is. I've never done this before. Anyways, MLK in Vietnam.
That's a perfect book.
Why does anybody think of that?
Yeah. looks like I have two questions from Professor David Denton out of Illinois. So let me go ahead and ask the first one here. These are questions about ACSI. Was Colonel Burst
Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence, U.S. Army. Okay, actually, Army Intelligence.
Okay, was Colonel Burst definitely a member?
No.
Okay.
Not of ACSI. He was in the Air Force. Actually, okay. ACSI, that's what he's asking for,
yep.
I think. Well, that's the Army. That's the Army Intelligence. Now, Burst was an intelligence, but he was an Air Force intelligence and the CIA. They had a lot of stuff. They lost. He was in Switzerland together. So, yeah, that's the answer.
Okay. The second part of the question that is: Dorothy Matlack was a member and also liaison to CIA. Her assignment was to deal with defectors. Possible she may have dealt with Oswald. That's the question.
I don't have any evidence for that. Maybe she dealt with the whole Haiti thing. You know. Papadoc the fact that Haiti was a place where mafiosi took their money to, and Burris got involved in that because they were trying to get to LBJ to get him to do some things and get an audience with him, and Burris ended up stepping in even though Burris had been long gone. This is after 63, so. It's a very interesting episode that involves – it has lots of loose ends, and I spent quite a bit of time on it, but I haven't really written extensively on it yet, so I'll just leave it at that.
Okay. Daniel Boudreau asks, did National Security Memorandum number 263 lead to the JFK assassination?
No, because, I mean, that was already in train. By the time we get to there, they're going to actually – subvert that. So op plan 34A, which is the opposite of in 263, which is getting out, pulling out 1,000 guys by the end of 63 and everybody else in 64. And it was an accelerated plan, but it didn't matter because General Taylor in Birkenau comes into the view again, and Krulak were part of the group that is privately behind McNamara's back and Kennedy's back, going to scuttle Kennedy's withdrawal plan and replace it with American intervention. So I'm kind of straying off. You're pulling me into 63, but I'll answer it because I've dealt with it in JFK and Vietnam. So, and I mentioned it a couple of times in our presentation yesterday and today that Taylor is going to betray Kennedy. So we watch this guy all the way back in World War II and see him try to get that lucky break. A guy dies. He takes over, the 101st Airborne Division. He ends up getting into the Eisenhower administration, and he's basically fired or invited to resign because he's doing flexible response, and Ike doesn't like that. Ike wants to keep all these missiles, and then so Lemnitzer was the deputy chief, so he steps in and becomes the chief of staff of the Army, and he's in, and Taylor's out, but Taylor gets back in, and how does he do that? Right, we have the Bay of Pigs failure, and so Kennedy likes this book, Uncertain Trumpet, and this whole idea of flexible response. So he asks him to come in. Now, ostensibly, his job is to critique the failure at the Bay of Pigs. Alain Dulles is invited to be a part of his own funeral there, and so on. But what happens is, he really wants him to be his military aide. He doesn't like anybody in the Pentagon, including Lemnitzer. And so, and everybody has the wrong idea. They think, oh shit, if Taylor gets in there, the Pentagon isn't going to like him. Lemnitzer's not going to like him. Everybody forgets that, Lemnitzer worked for him in the Eisenhower administration. They were very close. And I have a section in my book that covers this, and they made a deal. The two of them made a deal. The Lemnitzer and the Chiefs weren't unhappy to have Taylor there. Taylor said, look, here's what let's do. Whenever you want to do something, what the president does, why don't you tell me about it? I'll, beat the bushes and see what can fly, what can't, and I'll let you know so that you'll have the best chance to get what you want out of the president. So, this is what was going on with Taylor. But anyway, there was only one way to do this. At this point, there wasn't anybody on God's earth other than the Kennedy family that liked Bobby. And all of a sudden, when Taylor gets in there, he loves Robert Kennedy. Robert Kennedy can do no wrong. Now, what do you make of that? Well, it's really clear to me. He understood that the only way to really get inside, because he's a Trojan horse all the way. He needs to get back in the game, and he is not on Kennedy's side on Vietnam. And that's why he fights over the years as we track him through this to get that job once Lemnitzer goes over to Europe. So there's a chapter called Maxwell Taylor Trojan Horse in Volume 4. And that's not a view that anybody's had, and the least of all was Bobby, who named his son Maxwell, which I regret.
Okay. Doug Horn has a new question here for me, which is for you.
All right, Doug.
our friend Doug asks, is it fair and accurate to say from 10,000 feet altitude that the assassination plot against JFK was hatched or born very shortly after the end of the Cuban Missile Crisis, and that the peace speech and the test ban treaty and NSAM 263 were simply additional nails in his coffin?
Well, I would certainly say all that stuff in 62 are additional nails, but I think that the plot is in train when Oswald puts a placard around his neck that says Viva Fidel in January 1963. But that's just a hypothesis of mine. I could change my mind in a heartbeat, and, Doug might be right or somebody else might be right.
But I know that the plan is Doug's right about one thing. We're moving strongly towards how do we find an opportunity. His motive and means are there in the summer of 62. There's no question about that. But getting the opportunity to actually have a plan that might work and not everybody in the world knowing about it is a little bit tough to come up with. And so it's going to be at the end of 62 or early 63, I think, at the latest. So I wouldn't say that the nails in the coffin, there were lots of nails in the coffin before we got to the fall of 63. Just my opinion.
All right. Let's see. We have another question here. Let's see. This comes from Jack Taylor. After the assassination, why didn't the JCS's pressure LBJ to invade Cuba?
So, well, there's a couple things about that. The Cuban thing was actually in 1963. You see, when you look at the literature here of authors that and historians that have studied this, it's like the Cuban thing, we have 61 and 62 and then 63, oops, nothing going on. But that's not true. It was a true two-track policy. And again, you know, I'm reluctant to discuss this in any great detail because this is only what I have learned up to this point and it's not been my focus. So I'm aware that the Kennedys were trying to separate Cuba from Moscow. And if they could achieve that, then they could improve relations and do lots of things. But if not, then there was an autonomous plan, as they called it, where the White House was giving support to some of the Cuban exiles, but only if they were out of the country. And I don't want to get into all the details of that, but that's there. That there is that information is there. If somebody wants to go write about it right now, and people have. But that's what I know about what Kennedy was doing with respect to Cuba. Now, so why don't we go to Cuba? Why don't we do that? Well, the problem with that is you've got Johnson in there. And Johnson, clearly, his priority is Vietnam. First thing he tells everybody, I want you to tell those generals out there that, you know, that I mean business. I want this thing cleaned up, you know, like typical Johnson stuff. Johnson didn't like Vietnam, and he didn't like Cuba. He had the Great Society thing he wanted to do. And if you're fighting four wars on three fronts, you're not going to have any. And that's what happened, by the way. The Vietnam War and the Great Society were not—they bankrupted us. In strategic currency reserves, we had a hegemony over the whole planet before the war started, and afterwards, Germany and Japan that had been enemies had pulled up with us. So, you know, I think it would have been dumb to go fight in two places, less of the, you know what, blow the planet up. And what good is that going to do? They had so many damn missiles that they didn't realize that there wouldn't have been an Earth left if they'd gotten what they wanted. So thank God they didn't. Somebody, all we needed in 62 was one mistake, and we almost had one. There was a submarine commander, a Russian one, who thought it was all over, that the war had already started. And he only had one nuclear weapon on a torpedo. And his senior officers under him stopped him. And I'm 99% sure that if he had fired that missile, that would have been it. That would have been the spark that lit the prairie fire. And I was also kind of scared looking back thinking that Lemaitre would do something like that. He would shoot one, blame it on everybody else, and finish the job. I mean, he was that kind of guy. So we were very, very close. Very close, closer than a lot of people think. That if you just see the documentary on it, which is good, and 13 Days, Fire Cape, which is good, there were a lot of other considerations that require analysis, and it's not just, you know, I have this one document that tells me I'm going to do this. That people are going to do bad things generally don't write us memos to tell us about it, and we have to figure things out. So, but anyway, that's all I got on that. Probably talking too much.
Well, speaking of LBJ, this comes from Wayne Green. Is there any evidence or suspicion that LBJ had prior knowledge what was that was going to happen in Dallas?
Okay. I've spoken about this already, and I'm writing about it in Volume 4, so I'm willing to speak about it. Here's what's going on, and I'm going to stay disciplined on this so I don't talk too much. What we learned from all the stuff that came out of the LBJ library, and that was everything. You know, that's the vice presidential vice. He's not president yet. So I'm not talking about President Johnson. I'm talking about Vice President Johnson. What did he know, right? That's the question. And the answer is that, and this goes back to what I said about Burris, I guess it was yesterday. He gave me some good stuff to establish his bona fides on that secret back channel on Vietnam stuff. And then he put together this whole false story about LBJ ordering him to go to war, LBJ ordering him to come back from Switzerland, LBJ ordering him, and he jumps. LBJ says, jumping, and Burris jumps. And none of that was true. And I showed you a document where he said he flew this jet fighter and he was on a brand of airline in a tourist seat going back. So he made up a lot of stuff. But what he made up later about the past things in the 30s and 40s and when LBJ became the vice president was to take a story of LBJ being the one in charge and superimposing it all the way back to the oil rig back in the 1930s. So you have continuity. You have the same story of LBJ being the guy who's powerful and Burris not being. Now, Burris married the daughter, the head of Texas. You know, and LBJ was a country bumpkin for most of his life. He was running around and being like a sycophant to all these other people. And so it's the other way around from the very beginning. And so what is going on? Well, the person who brought in Burris was in the Pentagon. Burris's real boss wasn't LBJ. It was Birkenau. Birkenau wrote all of his fitness reports. And it was a big secret. And what was going on is that Burris was the case officer and LBJ was the understudy, and he had to be prepared to take over the presidency. And so whereas JFK was getting bogus stuff through the NSC, Burris's job was to make sure LBJ got the truth, not just on the Vietnam stuff, but across the board, every country in the world. And that's the first thing you notice when you go down there in that library, you start reading every document. Burris writes one or two or three every single day, and they're all correct, they're all accurate. As long as Johnson can stay sober, you know, he can learn a thing or two. But sometimes he had a problem with that.
All right. Well, it looks like we still have a few more questions here. Are you willing to take some more questions, Dr. Newman?
Sure. Yeah, as long as I can, you can hear me. I'm not getting hoarse. Yeah.
Right. Well, this one here is from Kip Burns again. Now, this question says, do we have a firm date of when was the decision to go to Dallas being made? Obviously, we have dates of when they planned the trip. But
right.
I think this question is asking, is there anything as far as maybe the plot? Is there any information you might have on that?
I would have very little personally. I know what David Lipton's written and others have written about this on trip planning. I'm looking at it from a sort of larger context. And he came back, Roswell came back, all Soviets. And then all of a sudden, in the first days of January, he's not doing that anymore. He's got his placard on his neck, Viva Fidel. I take it from that date that the plan's afoot. And I think trip planning doesn't come too far after that. I think it's early in the year. I can't remember.
Yeah.
Not my bag.
Let's see here. I'm cruising through to see what we can bring up here.
Not forensics.
not forensics.
Bessiana's off the table for right now, too. We're in the middle of litigation, so can't do him.
Okay, how about this one here? Is there any evidence that CIA Mexico City Station Chief Winston McKinley Scott was knowledgeable about the Gladio stay behind armies in Europe, since Mexico Station Chief Scott was between 1950 and 55, he was chief of the Western European Division of the Office of Special Operations?
You know, it's possible, but I don't know. I have nothing firm on that. I haven't seen documents that would show that. There's propinquity in terms of location, right? So we have lots of guys, like Harvey was head of the Berlin base. Oh, there's a whole bunch of guys that were in Berlin over there. But Gladio, that aspect of Gladio was extremely highly classified. And, you know, they didn't allow any paperwork to get out. So even most of the people in NATO didn't know about it. You only had the SACUR, and then you had the director of security. And the reason we know this is because we have all the Gladio books, but when we got hold of all these videos that had their transcribed, and I put all those together, it's really easy to see that, you know, very few people knew about that. So I'd be surprised if, you know, just because you were in Europe or in special operations in Europe, that you would know that kind of stuff. You would have to be in NATO.
Okay. Let's see what we got here. Okay, this one kind of goes back a little bit with that one as well. Considering that Bernardo de Torres, Chief of Intelligence for Assault Brigade 2506, was a decades-long covert asset of Dirección Federal de Seguridad, DFS, President Miguel Nazar Haro himself, an asset of CIA Station Chief Winston McKinley Scott, could not be argued that the Dulles Eisenhower policy of terrorist action against the Cuban people spawned the modern narco-terrorist mass murder campaigns on the U.S.-Mexico border.
Can't help you on that one.
Okay. So, Monty, I asked the first part of that question for you. Let's take a look here. Oh, while we're at it, why don't we take a break from questioning for just a quick second here, and maybe that will let some people come in, but I want to share something here real fast. I would like to point out to everybody that Dr. Newman does have a website, and you can search for his website by typing in jfkjmn.com, or you can also go to projectjfk.com, click on the More tab where the affiliated sites is, and you will find Dr. Newman's website right here. And this is being updated, and new stuff is added to it. But here you can find publications and books by Dr. John Newman. This has a video section. If you want to know about the Vitiana misdirection that we're not talking about, the last two nights, there's information there, and there's also a video.
Yeah, that was given to you, by the way, that 3.0. That was last November. Right. You guys, yeah.
Yeah, we had that in November of 2020, and that will be coming out very soon for everybody to be able to get a copy of if they haven't already seen it by attending one of our Project JFK events. Then yes, your presentation is available for people to get a hold of. But I just want to let people know that if you want to know more information and definitely want to see about what Dr. Newman is up to, please check out his website. Again, it's jfkjmn.com, or you can find him through our website at projectjfk.com.
Well, I will say something on Bessiana, which is just this.
it's the presentation that you have. You don't need anything more than that. If you look at all those documents, I mean, it's triple, quadruple independent attestation from all the people that were closest to him. You're never going to believe anything else because, I mean, I've heard people say something like, oh, it's settled for me. Okay, glad it is. But, you know, it's not for me. I changed my mind depending on what happens. And I remember working with Dan Hardway in the beginning. He's the one who put me onto it. People were calling him up, asking him, you heard this crazy stuff no one's talking about? And he would say, yeah, you know, I'm the one who told him to do it. I agree with what he's saying. And so the other thing I would mention is a Lancer presentation I made maybe the previous year. Yeah, it's going to be in 2018, I think. Anyway, some weird stuff happened. Somebody lifted my phone from me and put it back in, and some guy came up as soon as I was done with the Vesiana briefing, before anybody else could get up there, and he was dressed, slacks and a sport coat, looked to be about graying hair, maybe in his 50s. And very excitedly, he said, you're okay, you're okay, you're safe, they just want to know what you know. I didn't pay any attention to that. Well, now we've come to find out that within, you know, a few months after that presentation down there, all of a sudden, a bunch of Vesiana documents are being destroyed.
I remember that happening back in 2017.
Yeah.
That was the year that happened.
Yeah, 2017, yeah. So there's all kinds of nonsense going on. It was a very important story. You know, everybody who's sitting here watching this tonight probably knows about this claim that Vesiana observed David Atlee Phillips and Oswald in the fall of 1963. And anyway, good luck with that. That's all I can say because the tsunami is coming. And best thing you can do is, before opening mouth, is just wait until it's all over. That's all I can say. Can't tell you what we're finding out right now.
I think we're going to close with one more question. This comes from Larry Snaff. Harvey, as Berlin station chief, his team was sending displaced persons back into Eastern Europe to serve as spies and create stay-behind capabilities. He interacted with other Allied intelligence agencies. Is it really a stretch that he would know about Gladio?
I don't think so. Actually, he was opposed to doing that. He was told to do that. And he authored a couple of memos, which I've seen, which said, this is ridiculous. The Stasi has so much power, and we're just walking into a trap. So that was an operation that came down from on high to him from headquarters. He didn't want to do it, and they didn't do it. Except for just a very little bit. And I don't think anything we ever tried to do, sending agents into East Germany, worked. We went through that with the Galen stuff after through all that. And we got out of that was KGB turned a lot of their people and were infiltrating the CIA. So trying to, you know, to send agents in. The only thing that did happen, I will say this. The security research staff of the CIA's Office of Security at some point, I think I mentioned this. I did last night, yesterday, had an operation in a place real close to where you could get into Czechoslovakia through West Germany, a little finger that pointed in there. And they went in there and kidnapped Soviet agents, and they brought them back out, scrambled their brains as part of Bluebird and Artichoke, and turned them into vegetables and then buried them. And all this stuff is documented. Except for a hit-and-run operation to go get somebody, interrogate him, and kill him, what your questioner was talking about, was it Larry? So what you're talking about there is actually establishing an agent base.
in a hostile zone where you there's so much intelligence that and everything we tried to do in the Soviet Union failed too. Everybody died they sent in there. Except for Oswald.
Well, I think we're going to go ahead and close our Q&A session, and I'm going to give my closing remarks. We hope that you've enjoyed our Spotlight series featuring Dr. John Newman. If you wish to see the replay of tonight's event or know someone who missed it, it will be posted on our website, projectjfk.com, and also on our YouTube channel tomorrow, sometime during the day. You can also visit the Project JFK CSI Dallas. Yeah, I've already read that. Make sure when you visit YouTube, click the thumbs up button and subscribe while you're there so you don't miss out on when we upload new content. I want to thank, along with Casey Quillen and Brian Edwards, we want to thank Dr. Newman for his continued dedication to seeking the truth about the assassination of President Kennedy. I want to send a thank you out to all of our audience and supporters for making these last two nights a success. And with that, Dr. Newman, would you like to have anything in closing?
Oh, yes. I just thank you for doing this, and thanks, everybody, for hanging out with us and trying to find out what's going on. Just keep your minds open. You never know what you're going to find. And if you do find something that challenges something you believe, let go of it, you know, and go with the flow. That's called police work, scientific method. It's fun to make mistakes. Especially when you figure out you made a mistake. You're one step closer to where you actually want to be, right? It's time to pull out a bottle of champagne and make a mistake and figure it out. That's all I'll say about that. So I had a good time with you guys. Bless you.
Well, and again, Armageddon Book 4 will be coming out hopefully end of the year. And when it comes out, we'll have Dr. Newman back on, and he can talk about the book. And get you guys to get a copy of that picked up and see what you don't know that he has discovered and has put in his new book. So with that, again, thank everybody.
Cheers.
And we'll close our meeting. Thank you, Dr. Newman.